Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This week on StoryWeb, Lydia Maria Child's poem, Over the River and Through the Wood. In the 19th century, Lydia Maria Child's name was nearly a household word. An outspoken abolitionist, women's rights supporter, and crusader for Native American rights, Child was also a prolific author. A journalist and editor, she wrote novels and short stories, often using fiction to express her anti-slavery views, poems and children's books, and domestic manuals for wives and mothers. Her most famous book, which went into 33 printings, was The Frugal Housewife, first published in 1829. 4 years later, she published an appeal in favor of that class of Americans called Africans, believed to be the first anti-slavery book published in the United States. She also served as editor for Harriet Jacobs's influential 1861 slave narrative, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. In all, Child wrote more than 50 books. Though Child was very prominent in her time, she comes down to us now primarily as the author of a poem originally published as The New England Boy's Song About Thanksgiving Day, more popularly known to us as Over the River and Through the Wood. It was included in her 1844 book, Flowers for Children. The poem features Child's reminiscences about visiting her grandfather's house during the cold New England winters. The Poetry Foundation, which credits her with being one of the most important American women writers of the 19th century, provides an outstanding overview of Child's life and work, writing, she wrote one of the earliest American historical novels, the first comprehensive history of American slavery, and the first comparative history of women. In addition, she edited the first American children's magazine, compiled an early primer for the freed slaves, and published the first book designed for the elderly. Two other excellent introductions to Child can be found at American National Biography Online and the History of American Women website. You can visit transcendentalists.com to consider Child's relationship to other New England thinkers and writers of the time. Her work is also included in the Library of Congress's American Women Project. Look for her especially in the section titled Reform Efforts. If you want to go even further in your exploration of this key 19th century writer, you might want to read Laurie Kenshaff's book, Lydia Maria Child, The Quest for Racial Justice, or Carolyn L. Karcher's book, The First Woman in the Republic, A Cultural Biography of Lydia Maria Child. A Lydia Maria Child reader is available. And believe it or not, you can still buy a copy of The American Frugal Housewife.
context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, February 6, 2019. So I have been told this is our fourth study session on Harriet Jacobs' incidents in the life of a slave girl. We are picking up on chapter 23. Now, last week, we read the book. There was a metaphor where the author, Miss Jacobs, compared herself to Robinson Crusoe. Now, that is literary, a piece of legendary fiction in the annals of white supremacy. And that series was published in the early 1700s. The book that we're reading, Incidents, was published in 1861. So there was more than a century of this book, this story being told, retold, different editions and what have you. I said last week, it's possible she could have heard it, but I don't know. I put a pin in that. I emailed Dr. Martin Kevorkian, admitted white supremacist. He's been a guest on this program many times. He has a doctorate in English, teaches literature. We've talked, asked him about many literary questions, texts that we've read on the book over the years. So I asked him, you know, is it curious that she would reference Robinson Crusoe? He said, no, it's not strange to think that there, you know, could be something awry with that. He did say, however, just what I said, hey, that book, Robinson Crusoe had been out for over 100 years, and there were many shorter editions available. Harriet Jacobs could read. So it is very possible that she could have read an edition of this book or just heard it being mentioned, heard the story being told at someone at some point. That's very possible. However, to the greater point about the authenticity and or white influence on the text, Dr. Kevorkian said that that has been debated, studied for a number of years in terms of white influence on the text. I think one of our listeners, a female caller, mentioned a few weeks back, Lydia Maria Child, the white editor of this book, specifically Dr. Kevorkian. He sent me the article. It's titled Harriet Jacobs' Autobiography and the Voice of Lydia Maria Child. It's written by Albert H. Tracomi. It's about 30 pages, maybe a little more. Very interesting. It goes through a lot of the details and just kind of giving you some of the highlights from my reading of the report where they go through some of the letters that were exchanged and saved by Harriet Jacobs, by Lydia Maria Childs and others. The key point why I played the audio at the beginning there, Lydia Maria Childs, she was a literary titan, Stephen King of her time, if you will, published more than 50 books that you heard. So we're talking a power differential, and that's something that's emphasized in this report. Not just, this isn't just a white woman. This is a really powerful white woman who has written a lot of books, a literary titan, suspected race soldier. In the 1800s, where black people are still like being shackled, chained, raped, I'll sell your child on an auction block right now, form of white supremacy, where Harriet Jacobs could have been taken back at any time to be raped, sold, whatever. Enormous power differential and enormous difference in writing skill, education. I mean, it's just astronomical between these two. So in this report, they talk about how Lydia Maria Childs, she admits gleefully to reorganizing the book, rewording certain aspects of the book. We don't know which parts, and removing a chapter. This book was published in 1861. In 1859, John Brown, the infamous, his raid on Virginia's Harper's Ferry, that had a huge impact nationally. People still talk about the great John Brown. And Harriet Jacobs did, too. She was going to end her autobiography with that event and a much more violent, urgent, or I'll say counter-violent call to urgency that this problem of white supremacy racism needs to be dealt with and now and solved in any way possible. And if that means going upside a few white people's heads and killing them, well, then so be it. That is not what Lydia Maria Childs wanted, and she removed that chapter from the book. That's white influence. But it's really interesting. Report goes into a lot of detail. I'll try and share a few sections of it later. But it's titled Harriet Jacobs Autobiography and the Voice of Lydia Maria Child, White Woman. If you recall, we had this before with Zora Neale Hurston's Barracoon. There it was Charlotte the Godmother Mason. Remember, we just read that a few months back, 2018. But pattern with these types of narratives. Allegedly a black author, but maybe not. We'll go ahead and get started. This is chapter 23, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. In fact, the report even suggests that that is not the title that Harriet Jacobs intended for this text. We'll get started. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
Chapter 23, Still in Prison. When spring returned, and I took in the little patch of green the aperture commanded, I asked myself how many more summers and winters I must be condemned to spend thus. I longed to draw in a plentiful draught of fresh air, to stretch my cramped limbs, to have room to stand erect, to feel the earth under my feet again. My relatives were constantly on the lookout for a chance of escape, but none offered that seemed practicable, and even tolerably safe. The hot summer came again, and made the turpentine drop from the thin roof over my head. During the long nights I was restless for want of air, and I had no room to toss and turn. There was but one compensation. The atmosphere was so stifled that even mosquitoes would not condescend to buzz in it. With all my detestation of Dr. Flint, I could hardly wish him a worse punishment, either in this world or that which is to come, than to suffer what I suffered in one single summer. Yet the laws allowed him to be out in the free air, while I, guiltless of crime, was pent up here, as the only means of avoiding the cruelties the laws allowed him to inflict upon me. I don't know what kept life within me. Again and again I thought I should die before long, but I saw the leaves of another autumn whirl through the air, and felt the touch of another winter. In summer the most terrible thunderstorms were acceptable, for the rain came through the roof, and I rolled up my bed that it might cool the hot boards under it. Later in the season storms sometimes wet my clothes through and through, and that was not comfortable when the air grew chilly. Moderate storms I could keep out by filling the chinks with oakum. But uncomfortable as my situation was, I had glimpses of things out of doors which made me thankful for my wretched hiding-place. One day I saw a slave pass our gate, muttering, "It's his own, and he can kill it if he will." My grandmother told me that woman's history. Her mistress had that day seen her baby for the first time, and in the lineaments of its fair face she saw a likeness to her husband. She turned the bondwoman and her child out of doors, and forbade her ever to return. The slave went to her master and told him what had happened. He promised to talk with her mistress and make it all right. The next day she and her baby were sold to a Georgia trader. Another time I saw a woman rush wildly by, pursued by two men. She was a slave, the wet nurse of her mistress's children. For some trifling offence her mistress ordered her to be stripped and whipped. To escape the degradation and the torture, she rushed to the river, jumped in, and ended her wrongs in death. Senator Brown of Mississippi could not be ignorant of many such facts as these, for they are of frequent occurrence in every southern state. Yet he stood up in the Congress of the United States and declared that slavery was a great moral, social, and political blessing, a blessing to the master and a blessing to the slave. I suffered much more during the second winter than I did during the first. My limbs were benumbed by inaction, and the cold filled them with cramp. I had a very painful sensation of coldness in my head. Even my face and tongue stiffened, and I lost the power of speech. Of course it was impossible under the circumstances to summon any physician. My brother William came and did all he could for me. Uncle Philip also watched tenderly over me, and poor grandmother crept up and down to inquire whether there were any signs of returning life. I was restored to consciousness by the dashing of cold water in my face, and found myself leaning against my brother's arm while he bent over me with streaming eyes. He afterwards told me he thought I was dying, for I had been in an unconscious state 16 hours. I next became delirious, and was in great danger of betraying myself and my friends. To prevent this, they stupefied me with drugs. I remained in bed 6 weeks, weary in body and sick at heart. How to get medical advice was the question. William finally went to a Thompsonian doctor and described himself as having all my pains and aches. He returned with herbs, roots, and ointment. He was especially charged to rub on the ointment by a fire. But how could a fire be made in my little den? Charcoal in a furnace was tried, but there was no outlet for the gas, and it nearly cost me my life. Afterwards coals, already kindled, were brought up in an iron pan and placed on bricks. I was so weak, and it was so long since I had enjoyed the warmth of a fire, that those few coals actually made me weep. I think the medicines did me some good, but my recovery was very slow. Dark thoughts passed through my mind as I lay there day after day. I tried to be thankful for my little cell, dismal as it was, and even to love it, as part of the price I had paid for the redemption of my children. Sometimes I thought God was a compassionate Father who would forgive my sins for the sake of my sufferings. At other times it seemed to me there was no justice or mercy in the divine government. I asked why the curse of slavery was permitted to exist, and why I had been so persecuted and wronged from youth upward. These things took the shape of mystery, which is to this day not so clear to my soul as I trust it will be hereafter. In the midst of my illness, grandmother broke down under the weight and anxiety and toil. The idea of losing her, who had always been my best friend and a mother to my children, was the sorest trial I had yet had. Oh, how earnestly I prayed that she might recover! How hard it seemed that I could not tend upon her, who had so long and so tenderly watched over me! One day the screams of a child nerved me with strength to crawl to my peeping-hole, and I saw my son covered with blood. A fierce dog, usually kept chained, had seized and bitten him. A doctor was sent for, and I heard the groans and screams of my child while the wounds were being sewed up. What torture to a mother's heart to listen to this and be unable to go to him! But childhood is like a day in spring, alternately shower and sunshine. Before night Benny was bright and lively, threatening the destruction of the dog, and great was his delight when the doctor told him the next day that the dog had bitten another boy and been shot. Benny recovered from his wounds, but it was long before he could walk. When my grandmother's illness became known, many ladies, who were her customers, called to bring her some little comforts, and to inquire whether she had everything she wanted. Aunt Nancy one night asked permission to watch with her sick mother, and Mrs. Flint replied, "I don't see any need of your going. I can't spare you." But when she found other ladies in the neighborhood were so attentive, not wishing to be outdone in Christian charity, she also sallied forth in magnificent condescension, and stood by the bedside of her who had loved her in her infancy, and who had been repaid by such grievous wrongs. She seemed surprised to find her so ill, and scolded Uncle Philip for not sending for Dr. Flint. She herself sent for him immediately, and he came. Secure as I was in my retreat, I should have been terrified if I had known he was so near me. He pronounced my grandmother in a very critical situation, and said if her attending physician wished it, he would visit her. Nobody wished to have him coming to the house at all hours, and we were not disposed to give him a chance to make out a long bill. As Mrs. Flint went out, Sally told her the reason Benny was lame was that a dog had bitten him. "I'm glad of it," replied she. "I wish he had killed him. It would be good news to send to his mother. Her day will come. The dogs will grab her yet." With these Christian words she and her husband departed, and to my great satisfaction returned no more. I learned from Uncle Philip, with feelings of unspeakable joy and gratitude, that the crisis was past and grandmother would live. I could now say from my heart, "God is merciful. He has spared me the anguish of feeling that I caused her death. Chapter 24. The Candidate for Congress. The summer had nearly ended when Dr. Flint made a third visit to New York in search of me. Two candidates were running for Congress, and he returned in season to vote. The father of my children was the Whig candidate. The doctor had hitherto been a staunch Whig, but now he exerted all his energies for the defeat of Mr. Sands. He invited large parties of men to dine in the shade of his trees, and supplied them with plenty of rum and brandy. If any poor fellow drowned his wits in the bowl, and, in the openness of his convivial heart, proclaimed that he did not mean to vote the Democratic ticket, he was shoved into the street without ceremony. The doctor expended his liquor in vain. Mr. Sands was elected, an event which occasioned me some anxious thoughts. He had not emancipated my children, and if he should die, they would be at the mercy of his heirs. Two little voices that frequently met my ear seemed to plead with me not to let their father depart without striving to make their freedom secure. Years had passed since I had spoken to him. I had not even seen him since the night I passed him, unrecognized, in my disguise of a sailor. I supposed he would call before he left to say something to my grandmother concerning the children, and I resolved what course to take. The day before his departure for Washington I made arrangements, toward evening, to get from my hiding-place into the storeroom below. I found myself so stiff and clumsy that it was with great difficulty I could hitch from one resting-place to another. When I reached the storeroom my ankles gave way under me, and I sank exhausted on the floor. It seemed as if I could never use my limbs again. But the purpose I had in view roused all the strength I had. I crawled on my hands and knees to the window, and screened behind a barrel. I waited for his coming. The clock struck 9, and I knew the steamboat would leave between 10 and 11. My hopes were failing. But presently I heard his voice, saying to someone, "Wait for me a moment. I wish to see Aunt Martha." When he came out, as he passed the window, I said, "Stop one moment, and let me speak for my children." He started, hesitated, and then passed on and went out of the gate. I closed the shutter I had partially opened, and sank down behind the barrel. I had suffered much, but seldom had I experienced a keener pang than I then felt. Had my children, then, become of so little consequence to him? And had he so little feeling for their wretched mother that he would not listen a moment while she pleaded for them? Painful memories were so busy within me that I forgot I had not hooked the shutter, till I heard someone opening it. I looked up. He had come back. "Who called me?" said he in a low tone. "I did," I replied. "Oh, Linda," said he, "I knew your voice, but I was afraid to answer lest my friend should hear me. Why do you come here? Is it possible you risk yourself in this house? They are mad to allow it. I shall expect to hear that you are all ruined." I did not wish to implicate him by letting him know my place of concealment, so I merely said, "I thought you would come to bid grandmother good-bye, and so I came here to speak a few words to you about emancipating my children. Many changes may take place during the 6 months you are gone to Washington, and it does not seem right for you to expose them to the risk of such changes. I want nothing for myself. All I ask is that you will free my children, or authorize some friend to do it before you go." He promised he would do it, and also expressed a readiness to make any arrangements whereby I could be purchased. I heard footsteps approaching, and closed the shutter hastily. I wanted to crawl back to my den without letting the family know what I had done, for I knew they would deem it very imprudent. But he stepped back into the house to tell my grandmother that he had spoken with me at the storeroom window, and to beg of her not to allow me to remain in the house overnight. He said it was the height of madness for me to be there, that we should certainly all be ruined. Luckily he was in too much of a hurry to wait for a reply, or the dear old woman would surely have told him all. I tried to go back to my den, but found it more difficult to go up than I had to come down. Now that my mission was fulfilled, the little strength that had supported me through it was gone, and I sank helpless on the floor. My grandmother, alarmed at the risk I had run, came into the storeroom in the dark and locked the door behind her. "Linda!" she whispered. "Where are you?" "I am here by the window," I replied. "I couldn't have let him go away without emancipating the children. Who knows what may happen?" "Come, come, child," said she. "It won't do for you to stay here another minute. You've done wrong, but I can't blame you, poor thing." I told her I could not return without assistance, and she must call my uncle. Uncle Philip came, and pity prevented him from scolding me. He carried me back to my dungeon, laid me tenderly on the bed, gave me some medicine, and asked me if there was anything more he could do. Then he went away, and I was left with my own thoughts, starless as the midnight darkness around me. My friends feared I should become a cripple for life, and I was so weary of my long imprisonment that had it not been for the hope of serving my children, I should have been thankful to die. But for their sakes, I was willing to bear on. Chapter 25. Competition in Cunning. Dr. Flint had not given me up. Every now and then he would say to my grandmother that I would yet come back, and voluntarily surrender myself, and that, when I did, I could be purchased by my relatives, or any one who wished to buy me. I knew his cunning nature too well not to perceive that this was a trap laid for me, and so all my friends understood it. I resolved to match my cunning against his cunning. In order to make him believe that I was in New York, I resolved to write him a letter dated from that place. I sent for my friend Peter, and asked him if he knew any trustworthy seafaring person who would carry such a letter to New York, and put it in the post office there. He said he knew one that he would trust with his own life to the ends of the world. I reminded him that it was a hazardous thing for him to undertake. He said he knew it, but he was willing to do anything to help me. I expressed a wish for a New York paper to ascertain the names of some of the streets. He ran his hand into his pocket and said, "Here is half a one. That was round a cap I bought of a peddler yesterday." I told him the letter would be ready the next evening. He bade me good-bye, adding, "Keep up your spirits, Linda. Brighter days will come by and by." My Uncle Philip kept watch over the gate until our brief interview was over. Early the next morning, I seated myself near the little aperture to examine the newspaper. It was a piece of the New York Herald, and for once the paper that systematically abuses the colored people was made to render them a service. Having obtained what information I wanted concerning streets and numbers, I wrote two letters, one to my grandmother, the other to Dr. Flint. I reminded him how he, a gray-headed man, had treated a helpless child who had been placed in his power, and what years of misery he had brought upon her. To my grandmother I expressed a wish to have my children sent to me at the North, where I could teach them to respect themselves, and set them a virtuous example, which a slave mother was not allowed to do at the South. I asked her to direct her answer to a certain street in Boston, as I did not live in New York, though I went there sometimes. I dated these letters ahead, to allow for the time it would take to carry them, and sent a memorandum of the date to the messenger. When my friend came for the letters, I said, "God bless and reward you, Peter, for this disinterested kindness. Pray be careful. If you are detected, both you and I will have to suffer dreadfully. I have not a relative who would dare to do it for me." He replied, "You may trust to me, Linda. I don't forget that your father was my best friend, and I will be a friend to his children so long as God lets me live." It was necessary to tell my grandmother what I had done, in order that she might be ready for the letter, and prepared to hear what Dr. Flint might say about my being at the North. She was sadly troubled. She felt sure mischief would come of it. I also told my plan to Aunt Nancy, in order that she might report to us what was said at Dr. Flint's house. I whispered it to her through a crack, and she whispered back, "I hope it will succeed. I shan't mind being a slave all my life, if I can only see you and the children free." I had directed that my letter should be put into the New York post office on the 20th of the month. On the evening of the 24th, my aunt came to say that Dr. Flint and his wife had been talking in a low voice about a letter he had received, and that when he went to his office he promised to bring it when he came to tea. So I concluded I should hear my letter read the next morning. I told my grandmother Dr. Flint would be sure to come, and asked her to have him sit near a certain door and leave it open, that I might hear what he said. The next morning I took my station within sound of that door, and remained motionless as a statue. It was not long before I heard the gate slam, and the well-known footsteps enter the house. He seated himself in the chair that was placed for him, and said, "Well, Martha, I've brought you a letter from Linda. She has sent me a letter also. I know exactly where to find her, but I don't choose to go to Boston for her. I had rather she would come back of her own accord, in a respectable manner. Her Uncle Philip is the best person to go for her. With him she would feel perfectly free to act. I am willing to pay his expenses going and returning. She shall be sold to her friends. Her children are free, at least I suppose they are, and when you obtain her freedom you'll make a happy family. I suppose, Martha, you have no objection to my reading to you the letter Linda has written to you?" He broke the seal, and I heard him read it. The old villain! He had suppressed the letter I wrote to Grandmother, and prepared a substitute of his own, the report of which was as follows. "Dear Grandmother, I have long wanted to write to you, but the disgraceful manner in which I left you and my children made me ashamed to do it. If you knew how much I have suffered since I ran away, you would pity and forgive me. I have purchased freedom at a dear rate. If any arrangement could be made for me to return to the South without being a slave, I would gladly come. If not, I beg of you to send my children to the North. I cannot live any longer without them. Let me know in time, and I will meet them in New York or Philadelphia, whichever place best suits my uncle's convenience. Write as soon as possible to your unhappy daughter, Linda." "It is very much as I expected it would be," said the old hypocrite, rising to go. "You see the foolish girl has repented of her rashness and wants to return. We must help her to do it, Martha. Talk with Philip about it. If he will go for her, she will trust to him and come back. I should like an answer to-morrow. Good morning, Martha." As he stepped out on the piazza, he stumbled over my little girl. "Ah, Ellen, is that you?" he said in his most gracious manner. "I didn't see you. How do you do?"
"Pretty well, sir," she replied. "I heard you tell Grandmother that my mother is coming home. I want to see her."
"Yes, Ellen, I am going to bring her home very soon," rejoined he. "And you shall see her as much as you like, you little curly-headed nigger." This was as good as a comedy to me, who had heard it all, but Grandmother was frightened and distressed, because the doctor wanted my uncle to go for me. The next evening Dr. Flint called to talk the matter over. My uncle told him that from what he had heard of Massachusetts, he judged he should be mobbed if he went there after a runaway slave.
"All stuff and nonsense, Philip," replied the doctor. "Do you suppose I want you to kick up a row in Boston? The business can all be done quietly. Linda writes that she wants to come back. You are her relative, and she would trust you. The case would be different if I went. She might object to coming with me, and the damned abolitionists, if they knew I was her master, would not believe me if I told them she had begged to go back. They would get up a row, and I should not like to see Linda dragged through the streets like a common negro. She has been very ungrateful to me for all my kindness, but I forgive her, and want to act the part of a friend towards her. I have no wish to hold her as my slave. Her friends can buy her as soon as she arrives here."
Finding that his arguments failed to convince my uncle, the doctor let the cat out of the bag by saying that he had written to the mayor of Boston to ascertain whether there was a person of my description at the street and number from which my letter was dated. He had omitted this date in the letter he had made up to read to my grandmother. If I had dated from New York, the old man would probably have made another journey to that city. But even in that dark region where knowledge is so carefully excluded from the slave, I had heard enough about Massachusetts to come to the conclusion that slaveholders did not consider it a comfortable place to go in search of a runaway. That was before the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, before Massachusetts had consented to become a nigger hunter for the South. My grandmother, who had become skittish by seeing her family always in danger, came to me with a very distressed countenance and said, "What will you do if the mayor of Boston sends him word that you haven't been there? Then he will suspect the letter was a trick, and maybe he'll find out something about it, and we shall all get into trouble. Oh, Linda, I wish you had never sent the letters."
"Don't worry yourself, grandmother," said I. "The mayor of Boston won't trouble himself to hunt niggers for Dr. Flint. The letters will do good in the end. I shall get out of this dark hole some time or other."
"I hope you will, child," replied the good, patient old friend. "You have been here a long time, almost 5 years, but whenever you do go, it will break your old grandmother's heart. I should be expecting every day to hear that you were brought back in irons and put in jail. God help you, poor child. Let us be thankful that some time or other we shall go where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest."
My heart responded, Amen. The fact that Dr. Flint had written to the mayor of Boston convinced me that he believed my letter to be genuine, and of course that he had no suspicion of my being anywhere in the vicinity. It was a great object to keep up this delusion, for it made me and my friends feel less anxious, and it would be very convenient whenever there was a chance to escape. I resolved, therefore, to continue to write letters from the North from time to time. 2 or 3 weeks passed, and as no news came from the mayor of Boston, grandmother began to listen to my entreaty to be allowed to leave my cell, sometimes, and exercise my limbs to prevent my becoming a cripple. I was allowed to slip down into the small storeroom early in the morning, and remain there a little while. The room was all filled up with barrels, except a small open space under my trap-door. This faced the door, the upper part of which was of glass, and purposely left uncurtained, that the curious might look in. The air of this place was close, but it was so much better than the atmosphere of my cell that I dreaded to return. I came down as soon as it was light, and remained till 8 o'clock, when people began to be about, and there was danger that someone might come on the piazza. I had tried various applications to bring warmth and feeling into my limbs, but without avail. They were so numb and stiff that it was a painful effort to move, and had my enemies come upon me during the first mornings I tried to exercise them a little in the small, unoccupied space of the storeroom, it would have been impossible for me to have escaped. Chapter 26. Important Era in My Brother's Life. I missed the company and kind attentions of my brother William, who had gone to Washington with his master, Mr. Sands. We received several letters from him, written without any allusion to me, but expressed in such a manner that I knew he did not forget me. I disguised my hand and wrote to him in the same manner. It was a long session, and when it closed, William wrote to inform us that Mr. Sands was going to the North, to be gone some time, and that he was to accompany him. I knew that his master had promised to give him his freedom, but no time had been specified. Would William trust to a slave's chances? I remembered how we used to talk together in our young days about obtaining our freedom, and I thought it very doubtful whether he would come back to us. Grandmother received a letter from Mr. Sands, saying that William had proved a most faithful servant, and he would also say a valued friend, that no mother had ever trained a better boy. He said he had travelled through the northern states and Canada, and though the abolitionists had tried to decoy him away, they had never succeeded. He ended by saying they should be home shortly. We expected letters from William describing the novelties of his journey, but none came. In time it was reported that Mr. Sands would return late in the autumn, accompanied by a bride. Still no letters from William. I felt almost sure I should never see him again on southern soil, but had he no word of comfort to send to his friends at home, to the poor captive in her dungeon? My thoughts wandered through the dark past, and over the uncertain future. Alone in my cell, where no eye but God's could see me, I wept bitter tears. How earnestly I prayed to him to restore me to my children, and enable me to be a useful woman and a good mother. At last the day arrived for the return of the travellers. Grandmother had made loving preparations to welcome her absent boy back to the old hearthstone. When the dinner-table was laid, William's place occupied its old place. The stage-coach went by empty. My grandmother waited dinner. She thought perhaps he was necessarily detained by his master. In my prison I listened anxiously, expecting every moment to hear my dear brother's voice and step. In the course of the afternoon a lad was sent by Mr. Sands to tell grandmother that William did not return with him, that the abolitionists had decoyed him away. But he begged her not to feel troubled about it, for he felt confident she would see William in a few days. As soon as he had time to reflect, he would come back, for he could never expect to be so well off at the North as he had been with him. If you had seen the tears and heard the sobs, you would have thought the messenger had brought tidings of death instead of freedom. Poor old grandmother felt that she should never see her darling boy again, and I was selfish. I thought more of what I had lost than of what my brother had gained. A new anxiety began to trouble me. Mr. Sands had expended a good deal of money, and would naturally feel irritated by the loss he had incurred. I greatly feared this might injure the prospects of my children, who were now becoming valuable property. I longed to have their emancipation made certain, the more so because their master and father was now married. I was too familiar with slavery not to know that promises made to slaves, though with kind intentions and sincere at the time, depend upon many contingencies for their fulfillment. Much as I wished William to be free, the step he had taken made me sad and anxious. The following Sabbath was calm and clear, so beautiful that it seemed like a Sabbath in the eternal world. My grandmother brought the children out on the piazza that I might hear their voices. She thought it would comfort me in my despondency, and it did. They chatted merrily, as only children can. Benny said, "Grandmother, do you think Uncle Will is gone for good? Won't he ever come back again? Maybe he'll find Mother. If he does, won't she be glad to see him? Why don't you and Uncle Philip and all of us go and live where Mother is? I should like it, wouldn't you, Ellen?" "Yes, I should like it," replied Ellen. "But how could we find her? Do you know the place, Grandmother? I don't remember how Mother looked. Do you, Benny?" Benny was just beginning to describe me when they were interrupted by an old slave woman, a near neighbor, named Aggie. This poor creature had witnessed the sale of her children, and seen them carried off to parts unknown without any hopes of ever hearing from them again. She saw that my grandmother had been weeping, and said in a sympathizing tone, "What's the matter, Aunt Marthy?" "Oh, Aggie," she replied, "it seems as if I shouldn't have any of my children or grandchildren left to hand me a drink when I'm dying and lay my old body in the ground. My boy didn't come back with Mr. Sands. He stayed at the North." Poor old Aggie clapped her hands for joy. "Is that what you're crying for?" she exclaimed. "Get down on your knees and bless the Lord. I don't know where my poor children is, and I never expect to know. You don't know where poor Linda's gone to, but you do know where her brother is. He's in free parts, and that's the right place. Don't murmur at the Lord's doings, but get down on your knees and thank him for his goodness." My selfishness was rebuked by what poor Aggie said. She rejoiced over the escape of one who was merely her fellow bondman, while his own sister was only thinking what his good fortune might cost her children. I knelt and prayed God to forgive me, and I thanked him from my heart that one of my family was saved from the grasp of slavery. It was not long before we received a letter from William. He wrote that Mr. Sands had always treated him kindly, and that he had tried to do his duty to him faithfully. But ever since he was a boy he had longed to be free, and he had already gone through enough to convince him that he had better not lose the chance that offered. He concluded by saying, "Don't worry about me, dear grandmother. I shall think of you always, and it will spur me on to work hard and try to do right. When I have earned enough money to give you a home, perhaps you will come to the North, and we can all live happy together." Mr. Sands told my Uncle Philip the particulars about William's leaving him. He said, "I trusted him as if he were my own brother, and treated him as kindly. The abolitionists talked to him in several places, but I had no idea they could tempt him. However, I don't blame William. He's young and inconsiderate, and those northern rascals decoyed him. I must confess the scamp was very bold about it. I met him coming down the steps of the Astor House with his trunk on his shoulder, and I asked him where he was going. He said he was going to change his old trunk. I told him it was rather shabby, and asked if he didn't need some money. He said no, thanked me, and went off. He did not return so soon as I expected, but I waited patiently. At last I went to see if our trunks were packed, ready for our journey. I found them locked, and a sealed note on the table informed me where I could find the keys. The fellow even tried to be religious. He wrote that he hoped God would always bless me and reward me for my kindness, that he was not unwilling to serve me, but he wanted to be a free man, and that if I thought he did wrong, he hoped I would forgive him. I intended to give him his freedom in 5 years. He might have trusted me. He has shown himself ungrateful. But I shall not go for him or send for him. I feel confident that he will soon return to me." I afterwards heard an account of the affair from William himself. He had not been urged away by abolitionists. He needed no information they could give him about slavery to stimulate his desire for freedom. He looked at his hands and remembered that they were once in irons. What security had he that they would not be so again? Mr. Sands was kind to him, but he might indefinitely postpone the promise he had made to give him his freedom. He might come under pecuniary embarrassments, and his property be seized by creditors, or he might die without making any arrangements in his favor. He had too often known such accidents to happen to slaves who had kind masters, and he wisely resolved to make sure of the present opportunity to own himself. He was scrupulous about taking any money from his master on false pretenses, so he sold his best clothes to pay for his passage to Boston. The slaveholders pronounced him a base, ungrateful wretch, for thus requiting his master's indulgence. What would they have done under similar circumstances? When Dr. Flint's family heard that William had deserted Mr. Sands, they chuckled greatly over the news. Mrs. Flint made her usual manifestations of Christian feeling by saying, "I'm glad of it. I hope he'll never get him again. I like to see people paid back from their own coin. I reckon Linda's children will have to pay for it. I should be glad to see them in the speculator's hands again, for I'm tired of seeing those little niggers march about the streets." Chapter 27. New Destination for the Children. Mrs. Flint proclaimed her intention of informing Mrs. Sands who was the father of my children. She likewise proposed to tell her what an artful devil I was, that I had made a great deal of trouble in her family, that when Mr. Sands was at the North she didn't doubt I had followed him in disguise and persuaded William to run away. She had some reason to entertain such an idea, for I had written from the North from time to time, and I dated my letters from various places. Many of them fell into Dr. Flint's hands, as I had expected they would, and he must have come to the conclusion that I travelled about a good deal. He kept a close watch over my children, thinking they would eventually lead to my detection. A new and unexpected trial was in store for me. One day, when Mr. Sands and his wife were walking in the street, they met Benny. The lady took a fancy to him and exclaimed, "What a pretty little negro! Whom does he belong to?" Benny did not hear the answer, but he came home very indignant with the stranger lady, because she had called him a negro. A few days afterwards Mr. Sands called on my grandmother, and told her he wanted her to take the children to his house. He said he had informed his wife of his relation to them, and told her that they were motherless, and she wanted to see them. When he had gone, my grandmother came and asked what I would do. The question seemed a mockery. What could I do? They were Mr. Sands' slaves, and their mother was a slave, whom he had represented to be dead. Perhaps he thought I was. I was too much pained and puzzled to come to any decision, and the children were carried without my knowledge. Mrs. Sands had a sister from Illinois staying with her. This lady, who had no children of her own, was so much pleased with Ellen that she offered to adopt her and bring her up as she would a daughter. Mrs. Sands wanted to take Benjamin. When grandmother reported this to me, I was tried almost beyond endurance. Was this all I was to gain by what I had suffered for the sake of having my children free? True, the prospect seemed fair, but I knew too well how lightly slaveholders held such parental relations. If pecuniary trouble should come, or if the new wife required more money than could conveniently be spared, my children might be thought of as a convenient means of raising funds. I had no trust in thee, O slavery! Never should I know peace till my children were emancipated with all due formalities of law. I was too proud to ask Mr. Sands to do anything for my own benefit, but I could bring myself to become a supplicant for my children. I resolved to remind him of the promise he had made me, and to throw myself upon his honour for the performance of it. I persuaded my grandmother to go to him, and tell him I was not dead, and that I earnestly entreated him to keep the promise he had made me, that I had heard of the recent proposals concerning my children, and did not feel it easy to accept them, that he had promised to emancipate them, and it was time for him to redeem his pledge. I knew there was some risk in thus betraying that I was in the vicinity, but what will not a mother do for her children? He received the message with surprise, and said, "The children are free. I have never intended to claim them as slaves. Linda may decide their fate. In my opinion, they had better be sent to the North. I don't think they are quite safe here. Dr. Flint boasts that they are still in his power. He says they were his daughter's property, and as she was not of age when they were sold, the contract is not legally binding. So then, after all I had endured for their sakes, my poor children were between two fires, between my old master and their new master, and I was powerless. There was no protecting arm of the law for me to invoke. Mr. Sands proposed that Ellen should go for the present to some of his relatives, who had removed to Brooklyn, Long Island. It was promised that she should be well taken care of and sent to school. I consented to it, as the best arrangement I could make for her. My grandmother, of course, negotiated it all, and Mrs. Sands knew of no other person in the transaction. She proposed that they should take Ellen with them to Washington, and keep her till they had good chance of sending her, with friends, to Brooklyn. She had an infant daughter. I had had a glimpse of it as the nurse passed with it in her arms. It was not a pleasant thought to me, that the bondwoman's child should tend her free-born sister. But there was no alternative. Ellen was made ready for the journey. Oh, how it tried my heart to send her away, so young, alone, among strangers! Without a mother's love to shelter her from the storms of life, almost without memory of a mother. I doubted whether she and Benny would have for me the natural affection that children feel for a parent. I thought to myself that I might perhaps never see my daughter again, and I had a great desire that she might look upon me before she went, that she might take my image with her in her memory. It seemed to me cruel to have her brought to my dungeon. It was sorrow enough for her young heart to know that her mother was a victim of slavery, without seeing the wretched hiding-place to which it had driven her. I begged permission to pass the last night in one of the open chambers with my little girl. They thought I was crazy to think of trusting such a young child with my perilous secret. I told them I had watched her character, and I felt sure she would not betray me, that I was determined to have an interview, and if they would not facilitate it, I would take my own way to obtain it. They remonstrated against the rashness of such a proceeding, but finding they could not change my purpose, they yielded. I slipped through the trap-door into the storeroom, and my uncle kept watch at the gate while I passed into the piazza and went upstairs, to the room I used to occupy. It was more than 5 years since I had seen it, and how the memories crowded on me! There I had taken shelter when my mistress drove me from her house. There came my old tyrant to mock, insult, and curse me. There my children were first laid in my arms. There I had watched over them, each day with a deeper and sadder love. There I had knelt to God in anguish of heart to forgive the wrong I had done. How vividly it all came back! And after this long, gloomy interval I stood there, such a wreck! In the midst of these meditations I heard footsteps on the stairs. The door opened, and my Uncle Philip came in, leading Ellen by the hand. I put my arms round her and said, "Ellen, my dear child, I am your mother." She drew back a little and looked at me, and then with sweet confidence she laid her cheek against mine, and I folded her to the heart that had been so long desolated. She was the first to speak. Raising her head, she said inquiringly, "You really are my mother?" I told her I really was, that during all the long time she had not seen me, I had loved her most tenderly, and that now she was going away I wanted to see her and talk with her that she might remember me. With a sob in her voice she said, "I'm glad you've come to see me, but why didn't you ever come before? Benny and I have wanted so much to see you. He remembers you, and sometimes he tells me about you. Why didn't you come home when Dr. Flint went to bring you?" I answered, "I couldn't come before, dear. But now that I am with you, tell me whether you like to go away." "I don't know," said she, crying. "Grandmother says I ought not to cry, that I am going to a good place where I can learn to read and write, and that by and by I can write her a letter. But I shan't have Benny, or Grandmother, or Uncle Philip, or anybody to love me. Can't you go with me? Oh, do go, dear mother." I told her I couldn't go now, but sometime I would come to her, and then she and Benny and I would live together and have happy times. She wanted to run and bring Benny to see me now. I told her he was going to the north before long with Uncle Philip, and then I would come to see him before he went away. I asked if she would like to have me stay all night and sleep with her. "Oh, yes," she replied. Then turning to her uncle, she said pleadingly, "May I stay? Please, uncle, she is my own mother." He laid his hand on her head and said solemnly, "Ellen, this is the secret you have promised Grandmother never to tell. If you ever speak of it to anybody, they will never let you see your grandmother again, and your mother can never come to Brooklyn." "Uncle," she replied, "I will never tell." He told her she might stay with me, and when he had gone I took her in my arms and told her I was a slave, and that was the reason she must never say she had seen me. I exhorted her to be a good child, to try to please the people where she was going, and that God would raise her up friends. I told her to say her prayers and remember always to pray for her poor mother, and that God would permit us to meet again. She wept, and I did not check her tears. Perhaps she would never again have a chance to pour her tears into a mother's bosom. All night she nestled in my arms, and I had no inclination to slumber. The moments were too precious to lose any of them. Once, when I thought she was asleep, I kissed her forehead softly, and she said, "I am not asleep, dear mother." Before dawn, they came to take me back to my den. I drew aside the window curtain to take a last look of my child. The moonlight shone on her face, and I bent over her as I had done years before, that wretched night when I ran away. I hugged her close to my throbbing heart, and tears, too sad for such young eyes to shed, flowed down her cheeks as she gave her last kiss and whispered in my ear, "Mother, I will never tell." And she never did. When I got back to my den, I threw myself on the bed and wept there alone in the darkness. It seemed as if my heart would burst. When the time for Ellen's departure drew nigh, I could hear neighbors and friends saying to her, "Good-bye, Ellen. I hope your poor mother will find you out. Won't you be glad to see her?" She replied, "Yes, ma'am." And they little dreamed of the weighty secret that weighed down her young heart. She was an affectionate child, but naturally very reserved, except with those she loved, and I felt secure that my secret would be safe with her. I heard the gate close after her with such feelings as only a slave mother can experience. During the day my meditations were very sad. Sometimes I feared I had been very selfish not to give up all claim to her, and to let her go to Illinois and be adopted by Mrs. Sand's sister. It was my experience of slavery that decided me against it. I feared that circumstances might arise that would cause her to be sent back. I felt confident that I should go to New York myself, and then I should be able to watch over her, and in some degree protect her. Dr. Flynn's family knew nothing of the proposed arrangement till after Ellen was gone, and the news displeased them greatly. Mrs. Flint called on Mrs. Sand's sister to inquire into the matter. She expressed her opinion very freely as to the respect Mr. Sand showed for his wife and for his own character in acknowledging those young niggers. And as for sending Ellen away, she pronounced it to be just as much stealing as it would be for him to come and take a piece of furniture out of her parlor. She said her daughter was not of age to sign the bill of sale, and the children were her property, and when she became of age or was married, she could take them wherever she could lay hands on them. Miss Emily Flint, the little girl to whom I had been bequeathed, was now in her 16th year. Her mother considered it all right and honorable for her or her future husband to steal my children, but she did not understand how anybody could hold up their heads in respectable society after they had purchased their own children, as Mr. Sands had done. Dr. Flint said very little. Perhaps he thought that Benny would be less likely to be sent away if he kept quiet. One of my letters that fell into his hands was dated from Canada, and he seldom spoke of me now. This state of things enabled me to slip down into the storeroom more frequently, where I could stand upright and move my limbs more freely. Days, weeks, and months passed, and there came no news of Ellen. I sent a letter to Brooklyn, written in my grandmother's name, to inquire whether she had arrived there. Answer was returned that she had not. I wrote to her in Washington, but no notice was taken of it. There was one person there who ought to have had some sympathy with the anxiety of the child's friends at home, but the links of such relations as he had formed with me are easily broken and cast away as rubbish. Yet how protectingly and persuasively he once talked to the poor helpless slave girl, and how entirely I trusted him. But now suspicions darkened my mind. Was my child dead, or had they deceived me and sold her? If the secret memoirs of many members of Congress should be published, curious details would be unfolded. I once saw a letter from a member of Congress to a slave who was the mother of six of his children. He wrote to request that she would send her children away from the great house before his return, as he expected to be accompanied by friends. The woman could not read and was obliged to employ another to read the letter. The existence of the colored children did not trouble this gentleman. It was only the fear that friends might recognize in their features a resemblance to him. At the end of 6 months, a letter came to my grandmother from Brooklyn. It was written by a young lady in the family, and announced that Ellen had just arrived. It contained the following message from her. "I do try to do just as you told me to, and I pray for you every night and morning." I understood that these words were meant for me, and they were a balm to my heart. The writer closed her letter by saying, "Ellen is a nice little girl, and we shall like to have her with us. My cousin, Mr. Sands, has given her to me, to be my little waiting-maid. I shall send her to school, and I hope some day she will write to you herself." This letter perplexed and troubled me. Had my child's father merely placed her there till she was old enough to support herself?
or had he given her to his cousin as a piece of property? If the last idea was correct, his cousin might return to the South at any time and hold Ellen as a slave. I tried to put away from me the painful thought that such a foul wrong could have been done to us. I said to myself, surely there must be some justice in man. And then I remembered with a sigh how slavery perverted all the natural feelings of the human heart. It gave me a pang to look on my light-hearted boy. He believed himself free, and to have him brought under the yoke of slavery would be more than I could bear. How I longed to have him safely out of the reach of its power. End of chapter 27.
Context of white supremacy. So we are at the end of 27. We'll pick up at chapter 28, Aunt Nancy. That's where we'll start at for the second audio segment. If you have thoughts, questions, anything that stood out in the first audio segment, the number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Many things I could say. I did take notes, but I can only stress. I said last week, paying attention to metaphors, Robinson Crusoe. And again, I said last week, by the time Incidents was published, 1861, Robinson Crusoe had been out for more than 100 years. So if you can imagine Harry Potter or any other mega bestseller, The Hate U Give, that, you know, hey, 50 years from now, people will probably still be familiar with Harry Potter. So I can totally understand. 100 years, bestseller, many editions of this published. Books were really valued back in this time. So absolutely, she could have read it. That's what Dr. Kevorkian thought. And or she could have just heard someone else mention it. So, you know, that in of itself doesn't necessarily say that there's something untoward, the Robinson Crusoe. But there are many other aspects of this text that do, to me and to many others, suggest inauthenticity. In other words, racist fingerprints where whites have come in and edited, redacted, put something in, took something out. Lots of evidence of that. The report that Dr. Martin Kevorkian, who again many times has been a guest on this program, the report that he mailed me, and I linked it and shared it earlier in the day before the broadcast, Harriet Jacobs' Autobiography and the Voice of Lydia Maria Child. That is the white editor of this text. She's celebrated as a white abolitionist. You heard the audio clip at the beginning, published more than 50 books. I mean, you can think of that now. You're a Negro and you're working with a white person, male or female, and they've published over 50 books. And you're going to publish your first book and can barely read. And they're going to come and say that, oh, yeah, I'm going to help you edit your book. 2019, and think about that. Anyway, there are many highlights that I have from the text and from the article that is written by Albert H. Tricomi, T-R-I-C-O-M-I. That I would suggest. There's even, there are quite a few reports. Like I said, there are many people who read this book and said, you know, something about this seems fishy. So there's lots more research. There's a black female scholar as well, who writes about the influence of these white editors and practicing racism and going and distorting and outright sometimes muting the voice of these black authors in these slave narratives especially. More on that as we proceed. But folks who dialed in, if you have thoughts, commentary, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to chime in. Let's see. Mr. Dimrefore, if you have commentary, should be with us. I'll nab other lines as we proceed.
Yes, Fabio.
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers and listeners. I'm going to start out when she was, you know, a little further back in the book, when she was describing her conditions, you know, as an enslaved person. She said that, you know, she was never whipped, never, you know, her ankles were cut. She wasn't made to drag a log around all day long. But she said that she never wanted to escape until Dr. Flint. You know, and I thought about that for quite a while. I kind of looked through Frederick Douglass' narrative. And it just seems to me that a person that is made to wait on another person hand and foot every hour of the day would not be something that they would want to do. So they would desire to be free, if not only to pursue their own life, whatever that, you know, they could make of that. So I find it hard to believe that she never thought about escaping until this guy. It sounds you know, like she could be content with waiting around for other people. But anyway, I thought about the fact that she may have, she did confront Mr. Sands earlier in the book about his relationship with Linda. But I started to wonder if she didn't contribute something monetarily towards the release of William, which was, I think William was her son, and the kids of Linda. And, you know, I want to speak about Mr. Sands. You know, the book seems like, you know, painting this Mr. Sands like he's some kind of kind person that has promised to protect Linda and the kids. But we have to think about that, you know, the time and his position, he's benefited from this plantation environment, and he's raping young black females, he's impregnating them, and as this last reading shows, he becomes a slave owner himself, even enslaving his own kids. Now, it's said that Linda begged Mr. Sands to free her kids before he leaves Washington. But why would he have to beg her to free his own kids, you know, before we leave? I think that those kids, to him, were just a couple of niggas that when she begged him to free them, he did it, but he never kept any of his promises. The woman, they talked about a woman and her child being sold off because she had given birth to the slave owner's child, which she was powerless to resist giving birth. But when the slave owner's mistress saw the familiarity of the child, then she put them both out in the cold. And it's, the book seems to be like this, you know, it's been somewhat political and that is showing the inhumanity of slavery, but it's not showing any culpability towards white people. The slave owners' lives seem to be just as vicious or even more so than the slave owners themselves. When Benny was bit by a dog, one white woman said she hoped that he died. And the dog was later put down, but I think only after he probably had bitten a white child, because they didn't do anything to the dog after he bit Benny. But the book did point out that later on he was put down. And on chapter 24, I want to talk about revenge at Atrophy. She was close to losing her mind. Letters, writing letters, in a cunning way to throw off Dr. Frank, probably helped her sanity. There's probably thousands of enslaved people that lost their mind in this period of time. And then medicine, health care, was non-existence. There was no element that protected measles. There was no inoculations, just roots and other homeopathic remedies. But the slaves seemed like the best they could hope for was just death, and so that they would be troubled no more by something like that. The religious impact has on the enslaved people in this book just have them imbeciles to the fact that they never show any contempt towards white people. Even William, when he ran off, he seemed apologetic that he was leaving his slave master. Sands had became his slave owner. He decided to just run away, and best thing they could have ever done. And then Sands came back lying about the man running away, telling some the abolitionists trading. You know, they just minimize this whole process of dehumanizing other human beings and then make excuses for it. And the last thing, and they always thanking God, you know, for the worst case scenarios. This last reading, I was almost thinking about, thank God for what? But Ellen, Benny and Ellen, the worst thing she wanted to happen was they remained in slavery. It looked like that's what happened. And on top of that, they're separated, both given away into slavery. And I can't believe that after Linda found out what Mr. Sands had done and how he had lied, that she didn't express any anger.
Thank God is in the book quite a few times, as I was checking through a number of times. Thank God, thank God. What is there to be thankful about in these under these conditions? Let's see. I will keep an eye out if other folks have commentary as we proceed. I have my own notes to go through as well. If we have any folks who had an opportunity to read the report on the voice of Lydia Maria Child, certainly share your thoughts, observations on that. For me, it was so much more interesting listening to this week's audio, reading the book as well, with the information from the report and just hearing what Dr. Kevorkian had to say, period. In fact, I'll share the email from Dr. Kevorkian also, because he had interesting commentary. I can give you all of it. Let's see. And even before I get to that, if you go to Lydia Maria Child, if you go to her Wikipedia page, right? So she was born and died in Massachusetts. We heard the part about it being Massachusetts is no place for a slave master. You think you're going to come up here and get your nigger back, as though, you know, this is really tough white people against slave owners. On her Wikipedia page, it says, "Over the River and Through the Woods." I think that's a pretty famous poem. A lot of you all have probably heard it. I had. Her grandparents' house, which she wrote about visiting, was restored by Tufts University in 1976. I read the wrong sentence. Sorry. Her journals, both fiction and domestic manuals, reached wide audiences from the 1820s through the 1850s. At times, she shocked her audience as she tried to take on issues of both male dominance and white supremacy in some of her stories. This isn't one. I haven't heard anything in this text that seems like it is taking on white supremacy. If I missed that, please share. But that is what her Wikipedia page says, taking on issues of male dominance. Now that I can see patriarchy yet again, I can see that, but not white supremacy. I don't even see a slight lean for that. Okay, so Dr. Martin Kevorkian, he says, Incidents in the life of a slave girl is considered a very important document, but you are not illogical in your questions about some aspects possibly being inauthentic. There's been a lot of research done on the question of authenticity. One article that talks about the longstanding question is Harriet Jacobs' autobiography and the voice of Lydia Maria Child. I am attaching a PDF in case you are interested. It does not address the detail of Robinson Crusoe, which is a good catch. I do have some thoughts about how that might be an authentic detail, but I don't have anything conclusive. For example, a scholar of the period of the American Revolution notes that Robinson Crusoe, though a British book, was an American bestseller and was also available in many shortened editions. So there would have been a lot of copies in circulation in the United States outside of libraries and private homes, a key to Jacob's narrative, as it was for Frederick Douglass, mentioned already, was achieving literacy. So it is possible she could have happened upon the book and read it, as Douglass does with The Columbian Orator. Or it could be that Robinson Crusoe was just a household name commonly used in expressions like the one she uses. Or it could be that she read the book after achieving her freedom and used the metaphor retrospectively to describe her feelings about finding the gimlet, the pointy object. If it is indeed her metaphor and not something added by her white editor, I like how it casts her in the role of the person wielding the tool, inverting the relationship between the white Crusoe discovering his man Friday and essentially using that man as his tool. One expert on Harriet Jacobs is Professor Martha J. Cutter. She is professor of English and Africana Studies at the University of Connecticut. She is the author of Dismantling the Master's House, Critical Literacy in Harriet Jacobs, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. In that article, she describes critical literacy as not just reading the word, but reading the world. Professor Cutter writes, Jacobs does gain critical literacy. She understands how language has functioned to disempower her, but she also begins to challenge these signifying practices. Jacobs fashions a new relationship to language and finds a voice which challenges her culture's language practices, even as it creates its own. That's all in quotes from Professor Cutter. This is Dr. Kevorkian. What you are saying about the racist words used to describe that, this is all something related to, I'll have to share that later, related to something else. So that's Dr. Kevorkian about Harriet Jacobs. He does include the article if people want to read it. It is very interesting. Now, getting to the report, he mentioned several, but getting to the one that he mailed specifically, Harriet Jacobs' autobiography and the voice of Lydia Maria Child. The first point, he kind of outlines some of the problems with this text and the white woman, Miss Child, things that she either did or could have done with this text that would be a problem, may even be acts of racism. Number one, selection of the book's title. I thought this is a great point. He has more on that later. Number two, use of a pseudonym and the suppression of names, places, and dates. Very important. He gives more detail on that later. Number three, the reordering of narrative sequence. And number four, the cutting out the chapter on John Brown, which I mentioned before. And then he goes into detail about all four of those aspects of Lydia Child and how she influenced the text. So he says, critical as Child's role was in the publication process, I think it is essential to recognize that she stood as a mediator between Jacobs and the predominantly white public, especially Northern white women who were to be or thought to be her primary readership. Important to keep in mind. Continuing down, a few paragraphs. Enslaved narratives, especially those voices, have been muffled due to the mediation of their white editors. As Carla Peterson has argued, the currency enjoyed today by slave narratives and by Jacobs and Douglas's autobiographies in particular has made them the metonym for 19th century African-American literary production, with the result that literary criticism of the late 20th century has come dangerously close to replicating the historical situation of the early 20th century in its valorization of those African-American texts produced under the direction of white sponsors for the consumption of white readership while marginalizing other forms. I thought that was really important as well. Okay, so going to those 4 points. Number one, this title. Maybe Harriet Jacobs didn't want this book to be called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Tacoma, he writes, well over half of the autobiography treats Jacobs' adult life in the North, a life that began when Jacobs was just short of 30, and the author herself was about 40 when Amy Post first suggested that she write her life story. Under these circumstances, I don't think it is very likely that Jacobs would identify herself in the title as a girl or even characterize her life story as the experiences of a slave girl. I thought that was an exceptional point. Just looking at the age, I think anybody out there, if you are 25, 24, 34, 30, 37, how likely would it be if you were going to write your life story? Would it be called, you know, the life and times of a black boy, life and times of a black girl, if you are, as I said, 24, 39, in that age range? And in the system of white supremacy, is there a pattern? Not man, not woman. Boys and gals, doesn't matter, 19th century, 2019, boys and gals. There is a racist pattern there, I think. That was an excellent one with the title. Let's see, continuing. Let's see. She talks about, again, with the title, that Harriet Jacobs' ordering of the story is different. And I think you can get the original documentation, the way that Harriet Jacobs had this authored. I might be incorrect about that. I'll have to double check. But the ordering was different. And there are essays, letters, where Child writes this white woman. And she talks about, yes, I'm reordering in this. I'm putting it again, keeping my sheet written, published 50 books. This is what she does. White women controlling the publishing industry. That's still the case today. So the ordering, the author in this report is saying, being changed around so that you end up with a bunch of, a bunch of dramatic, dramatized theatrical events that are really heart-gripping, the breaking up of these families, the death, the prison scene, the harrowing, you know, trying to escape. Racial theater, that's kind of the way that I phrased it last week, so that it reads more like that in an entertaining manner, as opposed to this being presented as a call of action that we need to end slavery right now, which seems to be much more in line with the way that Harriet Jacobs intended this book to be written. Let's see. Next note talks about, he talks about changing the names. This is written under the pseudonym Linda Brandt, and he talks about the impact that had on this book, at least for the first few decades when it was read. It had the impact of making this seem like fiction because none of the details could be corroborated. There was no Linda Brandt in the area where people were looking, and the other names of the white slave masters, racists, they couldn't be found either. So changing all of the names, and this was not, you know, something that Harriet Jacobs was ecstatic about this was something that Linda Brandt wanted to do. Now, there were white people who were being protected with this, too. Some of the whites who allegedly helped Harriet Jacobs, we don't want to cause them too much trouble, so let's look out for some of them. There was some, you know, looking out for white interests in many different ways in that. But he spends a good deal of time and great detail talking about why this was significant, and in some ways, in significant ways, hindered this book and took it away from what Harriet Jacobs hoped to do with the text. Next. Let's see. Oh, this is talking again about the reordering. He says, again, if these inferences are correct, Child's transpositions, moving the text around, amount to a good deal more than artistic rearrangement, for they foreground the elements of female sexual abuse and maternal devastation, melodramatically treated at the expense of the more overtly political and ideological elements of the manuscript. Jacob's edited book, Child Told Whittier, on March 1861, is, and this is in quotes, as interesting as romance, as at the same time true. The style is very lively and dramatic, all in quotes. For Child, this the book, and that was a Child talking about herself. For Child, the book is a romance in the format literary sense of being comprised of separations and reunions, hairbreadth escapes, and exhibitions of virtue assaulted and defended. By placing the slave mother's desolations early in the manuscript, she foregrounded these highly dramatic, romantic elements, thereby driving the manuscript more concertedly toward the sentimental and the maternal. Likewise, if Child, as I have argued, postponed Jacob's early emphasis on resistance and the quest for freedom among male as well as female slaves until what is now chapter 4, she coincidentally diminished the importance of these themes. And I do not think that is an accident at all. That's huge. She also talked, or Mr. Tomek in this text, he talks about how they squished a lot of the ills of slavery into one chapter so that people didn't want to hear about all of that, the brutality and the torturing. They could just skip over that if people didn't want to hear any of that. And they also, just in the reordering of the text, in really minimizing how much Harriet Jacobs talked about ending slavery now, that this was supposed to be a call to action, that all of this is horrible, that this is not just supposed to be a wham, oh, this is sad, the Negroes got it tough. This was supposed to be an, oh, we should be doing something about this. Let's go solve this problem right now. That was what Harriet Jacobs wanted. That does not seem to be what Lydia Maria Child wanted. No surprise, suspected race soldier. Let's see if there's any. And the omission of the John Brown chapter is big. I don't want to harp too much on that because, in my view, John Brown still would be a suspected race soldier. But just that was such a huge event. Again, 2 years before this book was published, that's what she was going to end on, and saying that that is the sort of action and spirit that we need, people that are trying to solve this problem right now, not pussyfooting and sitting around and just talking and talking and, oh, ain't it bad? No, let's go solve this problem right now. Spirit of urgency. That's what Harriet Jacobs wanted. Too militant. Too militant. We don't want any of that. And again, who's supposed to be reading this book? White women. We don't want to offend them. We want to make sure that they read the book and, you know, don't get, think, wow, we got some uppity militant Negro trying to, you know, disrupt the business that is doing well by us as well, whites here in the North. Let's see if there's any other text I need to read from that before I go back to the book. Let's see. I think that might do it. There are many other things I could have read. It has a lot of great information. Might even try and get one of these authors on the program to talk more in depth about this, because I do think this is important. I hear a lot of black people who praise and revere the this text. Some of the others that we've talked about, Frederick Douglass, Solomon Northup, 12 Years a Slave, where white people have directly, even Barra Coombs or Neil Hurston, where whites have directly or indirectly had a huge influence on these texts, and in my view, not in a constructive manner, in a manner that supports the system of white supremacy. I've talked about some already. Thank God, how many times that's it. Kindly white people, how many times that's it. removing the chapter on John Brown. We don't want to think about counter-violence to solve this problem. Going back to the actual text, and again, if other folks, if you have comments, thoughts that you'd like to share, feel free. The portion where they talked about the child being bitten, by the dog and having, you know, get the doctor to come in, it reminded me of the Delectable Negro again, where black bodies can become food. A lot of Delectable Negro is about starving black people and controlling their access to food. It also talks about black people being eaten and just being flesh to be consumed, sometimes by people, sometimes by dogs. I think that's been presented a few times in the text, dogs chewing on eating black people. Let's see. Oh, and it comes up again. They say in the very next session, childhood is like a day in spring, alternately shower and sunshine. I don't know whether that's such a metaphor for slavery. I don't know what the sunshine would be for a black child on a plantation. Anyway, it continues. Before night, Benny was bright and lively, bright, threatening the destruction of the dog, and great was his delight when the doctor told him the next day that the dog had bitten another boy and been shot. So this, you know, all day long, niggers being chewed on. Let's see. Chapter 25, Competing in Cunning. I'd heard about Massachusetts to come to the conclusion that slaveholders did not consider it a comfortable place to go in search of a runaway. That was before the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, before Massachusetts had consented to become a nigger hunter for the South. This passage stuck out to me a lot. This sounds like Lydia Maria Child's vividly. As I said, she was born and died in Massachusetts. And so you get a small plug as though, oh, wow, these are not racist white people. Couldn't be true at all. Pause for I'm blanking on his name. It's Boston. They said Boston is one of the most racist cities ever. The white man, Charles Stewart. Yes, Charles Stewart. Pause for Charles Stewart. But the Fugitive Slave Law and Massachusetts being required to return the Negro property below the Mason-Dixon, this just sounds like a white person who is angling in their political views from the 19th century. We don't want to have to be participating in returning your nigger property. This doesn't sound like something that would be a primary concern and written in this manner by Harriet Jacobs, although I could be in error. Let's see. I did think it was important, the section where she talks about how at first when she heard that her brother had escaped, he had been scammed, deceived by some of the scoundrel abolitionists while traveling north with his white slave owner. She says she was upset first when hearing that he had escaped because it would make her situation more difficult for she and her children. And then, you know, she was reminded like, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, he's, you know, being tortured and victim of terrorism. I'd stop and be thankful that he's free from this. And it just it reminded me the system of white supremacy, I think, can generally make victims of white supremacy very focused on self. We can kind of forget about other people. Other non-white people are also victims of racism because we're in such a terrible position. You can just become very, I don't want to say selfish, but just very focused on yourself and kind of losing sight of, oh, there are billions of people on the planet who are in the same position as I am at the bottom of the boat, back of the bus. Like, oh, can be very easy to forget when you are being terrorized. Let's see. Getting one, the chapter 27, New Destination for the Children, where she's talking about this, trying to negotiate and figure out if she can get her children agree so that her children will be free, whatever that means. And she says, if she was distrustful of just saying, well, you know, these are his children, so he'll do it. Because she'd seen too many times before where slave owners would end up in a tough spot, or they need some money, or they marry another woman, and she, you know, has expensive tastes, so they got to sell two or eight of the niggers off. And so she said she didn't trust that. She said specifically, if pecuniary trouble should come, or if the new wife required more money than could conveniently be spared, my children might be thought of as a convenient means of raising funds. I had no trust in thee, oh, slavery. That's one, again, could be the white woman, Lydia Maria Child. It's no trust of white people. That's what is said in The half has never been told Edward Baptist that black people could not trust any white person. That's the way he says it. It's not that you couldn't trust slavery. You couldn't trust white people. They're the ones who are deceptive. They're the ones who are practicing racism. They're the ones who will lie to you and have you shackled and sold off, free papers or no. I will pause there. Let's see. We have any other folks. If you have comments, questions, thoughts that you would like to share. Again, if we have any of the folks, if you got a chance to read the report, I would definitely recommend checking it out. Or I guess there are several. So at least if you got the one that I posted online, if you got a chance to check it out, feel free to share a thought. Any of the other folks who dialed in, thoughts, questions from the first audio segment, or folks content? Guess folks are good for the time being. See, I did have a few other notes. We still have the second audio segment. Let's see. Might give time. Give maybe a few more minutes just in case folks have anything that stood out. I would say going into more detail, this is one of the books I had not read before we examined it on the book club. And I'd always heard about this book and people lionizing it and, you know, Harriet Jacobs and, you know, right on, black freedom fighter and all that. Not that I'm disagreeing with any of that, but I am saying it does make me think substantially. It does make me think in a very different manner about this book, knowing that this is yet again, we have a white ghostwriter and I got to read this book much more critically and thinking, well, what's their influence? What part of this did Harriet Jacobs write? What part of this did the white woman write? What part of this should I think about a little more, you know, carefully? It just gives me a lot more pause. And that's, you know, the same thing that I've said repeatedly. That's rampant. That's why I said we might have to end up having a program about this, because I had some of the exact same critiques when we read Solomon Northup, 12 Years a Slave, and when we read Zora Neale Hurston, Barracoon, just as I said a few months back. This is very, very common, and even expands beyond the slave biography genre, where you have Madiba, who was 27 years. I mean, hey, he could be a slave too. But Nelson Mandela, he had a white co-author, ghostwriter, with his situation as well. That's why I said it's so rampant. I think even Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It, I think he had a white editor with his as well. It's so rampant. It's just many, many times you think you are getting the genuine, unadulterated voice of a black person who's trying to think about and solve the problem of white supremacy, racism, and frequently it is not, or at least it has been tampered with greatly. And I'll stop there. Folks satisfied or any other comments? We'll move on to audio segment number two. We'll get to audio segment two. If you have, oh, wait a minute, Mr. Demery Ford.
Yes, I was wondering, did you, in reading this book, did you think that Aunt Martha had conspired, or maybe conspired might not be the word, but worked with Mr. Sands on the release of the grandkids and her son?
You said, I just didn't hear the word, that Aunt Martha, did she something with Mr. Sands on the release of her children?
Yeah. Do you think she contributed monetarily? Like, do you think she gave any of her money to Mr. Sands to help with the release of her kin?
It's possible. It's possible. Yeah, I mean, that would just be guessing. Did something in the text stand out that made you think that that could, or maybe that happened?
Well, no, not particularly, but I know that Aunt Martha was able to make money. She sold baked goods and did other things that to procure, some monetary gain. And she was also working to try to purchase, her relatives. I think she had secured at least one person. But, it's just a thought. I don't know. I didn't think so, but because it would be right in line with Mr. Sam's conniving and not carrying through on his word if he didn't. If he used his money to get the kids out, then she even told herself why he would do such a thing with the kids after he secured them. But it looked like it was a monetary thing for him, and it wasn't at all like she pictured it. So I was just wondering if he had stolen from A. Martin also in his little conniving, but maybe not.
It seems very logical. I know we've had a lot of in this book and through in many of the other books that we've read that have dealt with this period of slavery, white supremacy, black people trying to purchase their freedom or children's freedom or somebody else's quote unquote freedom was very common. So absolutely. And as you said, it could have just been, I'll steal some. If I'm going to let them go, then, that means you'll have to do this, or I'll, if you are making money on the side, I'll take, a little bit more from you or whatever. I mean, there's so many different ways that they have of doing that, or just outright lying about doing it to begin with. So yeah, it's possible. Yeah. If folks are satisfied, no other comments, we will go ahead and resume. So we are on chapter 28, I believe, memory is correct. We are making tremendous time on Nancy, not to be confused, making tremendous time through the text. I think we might even be done with this book next week. Have to double check, but we are closing rapidly. Chapter 28, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. Harriet Jacobs, edited by suspected race soldier Lydia Maria Child. Audio segment number 2, The Cows.
Chapter 28, Aunt Nancy. I have mentioned my great-aunt, who was a slave in Dr. Flint's family, and who had been my refuge during the shameful persecutions I suffered from him. This aunt had been married at 20 years of age, that is, as far as slaves can marry. She had the consent of her master and mistress, and a clergyman performed the ceremony. But it was a mere form, without any legal value. Her master or mistress could annul it any day they pleased. She had always slept on the floor in the entry, near Mrs. Flint's chamber door, that she might be within call. When she was married, she was told she might have the use of a small room in an outhouse. Her mother and her husband furnished it. He was a seafaring man, and was allowed to sleep there when he was at home. But on the wedding evening, the bride was ordered to her old post on the entry floor. Mrs. Flint at that time had no children, but she was expecting to be a mother, and if she should want a drink of water in the night, what could she do without her slave to bring it? So my aunt was compelled to lie at her door, until one midnight she was forced to leave to give premature birth to a child. In a fortnight she was required to resume her place on the entry floor, because Mrs. Flint's babe needed her attentions. She kept her station there through summer and winter, until she had given premature birth to 6 children, and all the while she was employed as night nurse to Mrs. Flint's children. Finally, toiling all day and being deprived of rest at night, completely broke down her constitution, and Dr. Flint declared it was impossible she could ever become the mother of a living child. The fear of losing so valuable a servant by death now induced them to allow her to sleep in her little room in the outhouse, except when there was sickness in the family. She afterwards had 2 feeble babes, one of whom died in a few days, and the other in 4 weeks. I well remember her patient sorrow as she held the last dead baby in her arms. "I wish it could have lived," she said. "It is not the will of God that any of my children should live. but I will try to be fit to meet their little spirits in heaven." Aunt Nancy was housekeeper and waiting-maid in Dr. Flint's family. Indeed, she was the factotum of the household. Nothing went on well without her. She was my mother's twin sister, and as far as was in her power, she supplied a mother's place to us orphans. I slept with her all the time I lived in my old master's house, and the bond between us was very strong. When my friends tried to discourage me from running away, she always encouraged me. When they thought I had better return and ask my master's pardon, because there was no possibility of escape, she sent me word never to yield. She said if I persevered, I might, perhaps, gain the freedom of my children, and even if I perished in doing it, that was better than to leave them to groan under the same persecutions that had blighted my own life. After I was shut up in my dark cell, she stole away whenever she could to bring me the news and say something cheering. How often did I kneel down to listen to her words of consolation whispered through a crack? "I am old, and have not long to live," she used to say, "and I could die happy if I could only see you and the children free. You must pray to God, Linda, as I do for you, that he will lead you out of the darkness." I would beg her not to worry herself on my account, that there was an end of all suffering sooner or later, and that whether I lived in chains or in freedom, I should always remember her as the good friend who had been the comfort of my life. A word from her always strengthened me, and not me only. The whole family relied upon her judgment, and were guided by her advice. I had been in my cell 6 years when my grandmother was summoned to the bedside of this, her last remaining daughter. She was very ill, and they said she would die. Grandmother had not entered Dr. Flint's house for several years. They had treated her cruelly, but she thought nothing of that now. She was grateful for permission to watch by the deathbed of her child. They had always been devoted to each other, and now they sat looking into each other's eyes, longing to speak of the secret that had weighed so much on the hearts of both. My aunt had been stricken with paralysis. She lived but 2 days, and the last day she was speechless. Before she lost the power of utterance, she told her mother not to grieve if she could not speak to her, that she would try to hold up her hand to let her know that all was well with her. Even the hard-hearted doctor was a little softened when he saw the dying eyes moisten for a moment, as he said she had always been a faithful servant, and they should never be able to supply her place. Mrs. Flint took to her bed, quite overcome by the shock. While my grandmother sat alone with the dead, the doctor came in, leading his youngest son, who had always been a great pet with Aunt Nancy, and was much attached to her. "Martha," said he, "Aunt Nancy loved this child, and when he comes where you are, I hope you will be kind to him for her sake." She replied, "Your wife was my foster child, Dr. Flint, the foster sister of my poor Nancy, and you little know me if you think I can feel anything but goodwill for her children." "I wish the past could be forgotten, and that we might never think of it," said he, "and that Linda would come to supply her aunt's place. She would be worth more to us than all the money that could be paid for her. I wish it for your sake also, Martha. Now that Nancy is taken away from you, she would be a great comfort to your old age." He knew he was touching a tender chord. Almost choking with grief, my grandmother replied, "It was not I that drove Linda away. My grandchildren are gone, and of my 9 children only 1 is left. God help me." To me, the death of this kind relative was an inexpressible sorrow. I knew that she had been slowly murdered, and I felt that my troubles had helped to finish the work. After I heard of her illness, I listened constantly to hear what news was brought from the great house, and the thought that I could not go to her made me utterly miserable. At last, as Uncle Philip came into the house, I heard someone inquire, "How is she?" And he answered, "She is dead." My little cell seemed whirling round, and I knew nothing more till I opened my eyes and found Uncle Philip bending over me. I had no need to ask any questions. He whispered, "Linda, she died happy." I could not weep. My fixed gaze troubled him. "Don't look so," he said. "Don't add to my poor mother's trouble. Remember how much she has to bear, and that we ought to do all we can to comfort her." "Ah, yes. That blessed old grandmother, who for 73 years had borne the pelting storms of a slave mother's life, she did indeed need consolation. Mrs. Flint had rendered her poor foster sister childless, apparently without any compunction, and with cruel selfishness had ruined her health by years of incessant, unrequited toil and broken rest. But now she became very sentimental. I suppose she thought it would be a beautiful illustration of the attachment existing between slaveholder and slave if the body of her old, worn-out servant was buried at her feet. She sent for the clergyman and asked if he had any objection to burying Aunt Nancy in the doctor's family burial place. No colored person had ever been allowed interment in the white people's burying ground, and the minister knew that all the deceased of your family reposed together in the old graveyard of the slaves. He therefore replied, "I have no objection to complying with your wish, but perhaps Aunt Nancy's mother may have some choice as to where her remains shall be deposited." It had never occurred to Mrs. Flint that slaves could have any feelings. When my grandmother was consulted, she at once said she wanted Nancy to lie with all the rest of her family, and where her own old body would be buried. Mrs. Flint graciously complied with her wish, though she said it was painful to her to have Nancy buried away from her. She might have added, with touching pathos, "I was so long used to sleep with her lying near me on the entry floor." My Uncle Philip asked permission to bury his sister at his own expense, and slaveholders are always ready to grant such favors to slaves and their relatives. The arrangements were very plain, but perfectly respectable. She was buried on the Sabbath, and Mrs. Flint's minister read the funeral service. There was a large concourse of colored people, bond and free, and a few white persons who had always been friendly to our family. Dr. Flint's carriage was in the procession, and when the body was deposited in its humble resting-place, the mistress dropped a tear and returned to her carriage, probably thinking she had performed her duty nobly. It was talked of by the slaves as a mighty grand funeral. Northern travelers passing through the place might have described this tribute of respect to the humble dead as a beautiful feature in the patriarchal institution, a touching proof of the attachment between slaveholders and their servants, and tender-hearted Mrs. Flint would have confirmed this impression with handkerchief at her eyes. We could have told them a different story. We would have given them a chapter of wrongs and sufferings that would have touched their hearts, if they had any hearts to feel for the colored people. We could have told them how the poor old slave mother had toiled year after year to earn $800 to buy her son Philip's right to his own earnings, and how that same Philip paid the expenses of the funeral, which they regarded as doing so much credit to the master. We could also have told them of a poor, blighted young creature, shut up in a living grave for years, to avoid the tortures that would be inflicted upon her if she ventured to come out and look on the face of her departed friend. All this, and much more, I thought of, as I sat at my loophole, waiting for the family to return from the grave, sometimes weeping, sometimes falling asleep, dreaming strange dreams of the dead and the living. It was sad to witness the grief of my bereaved grandmother. She had always been strong to bear, and now, as ever, religious faith supported her. But her dark life had become still darker, and age and trouble were leaving deep traces on her withered face. She had four places to knock for me to come to the trap door, and each place had a different meaning. She now came oftener than she had done, and talked to me of her dead daughter, while tears trickled slowly down her furrowed cheeks. I said all I could to comfort her, but it was a sad reflection that instead of being able to help her, I was a constant source of anxiety and trouble. The poor old back was fitted to its burden. It bent under it, but did not break. Chapter 29. Preparations for Escape. I hardly expect that the reader will credit me when I affirm that I lived in that little dismal hole, almost deprived of light and air, and with no space to move my limbs, for nearly 7 years. But it is a fact, and to me a sad one even now, for my body still suffers from the effects of that long imprisonment, to say nothing of my soul. Members of my family, now living in New York and Boston, can testify to the truth of what I say. Countless were the nights that I sat late at the little loophole, scarcely large enough to give me a glimpse of one twinkling star. There heard the patrols and slave hunters conferring together about the capture of runaways, well knowing how rejoiced they would be to catch me. Season after season, year after year, I peeped at my children's faces and heard their sweet voices, with a heart yearning all the while to say, "Your mother is here." Sometimes it appeared to me as if ages had rolled away since I entered upon that gloomy, monotonous existence. At times I was stupefied and listless. At other times I became very impatient to know when these dark years would end, and I should again be allowed to feel the sunshine and breathe the pure air. After Ellen left us, this feeling increased. Mr. Sands had agreed that Benny might go to the north whenever his Uncle Philip could go with him, and I was anxious to be there also, to watch over my children and protect them so far as I was able. Moreover, I was likely to be drowned out of my den if I remained much longer, for the slight roof was getting badly out of repair, and Uncle Philip was afraid to remove the shingles, lest someone should catch a glimpse of me. When storms occurred in the night, they spread mats and bits of carpet, which in the morning appeared to have been laid out to dry, but to cover the roof in the daytime might have attracted attention. Consequently, my clothes and bedding were often drenched, a process by which the pains and aches in my cramped and stiffened limbs were greatly increased. I revolved various plans of escape in my mind, which I sometimes imparted to my grandmother when she came to whisper with me at the trap door. The kind-hearted old woman had an intense sympathy for runaways. She had known too much of the cruelties inflicted on those who were captured. Her memory always flew back at once to the sufferings of her bright and handsome son, Benjamin, the youngest and dearest of her flock. So whenever I alluded to the subject, she would groan out, "Oh, don't think of it, child. You'll break my heart." I had no good old Aunt Nancy now to encourage me, but my brother William and my children were continually beckoning me to the north. And now I must go back a few months in my story. I have stated that the 1st of January was a time for selling slaves, or leasing them out to new masters. If time were counted by heart-throbs, the poor slaves might reckon years of suffering during that festival so joyous to the free. On the New Year's Day preceding my aunt's death, one of my friends, named Fanny, was to be sold at auction to pay her master's debts. My thoughts were with her during all the day, and at night I anxiously inquired what had been her fate. I was told that she had been sold to one master, and her four little girls to another master far distant, that she had escaped from her purchaser, and was not to be found. Her mother was the old Aggie I have spoken of. She lived in a small tenement belonging to my grandmother, and built on the same lot with her own house. Her dwelling was searched and watched, and that brought the patrols so near me that I was obliged to keep very close in my den. The hunters were somehow eluded, and not long afterwards Benny accidentally caught sight of Fanny in her mother's hut. He told his grandmother, who charged him never to speak of it, explaining to him the frightful consequences, and he never betrayed the trust. Aggie little dreamed that my grandmother knew where her daughter was concealed, and that the stooping form of her old neighbor was bending under a similar burden of anxiety and fear. But these dangerous secrets deepened the sympathy between the two old persecuted mothers. My friend Fanny and I remained many weeks hidden within call of each other, but she was unconscious of the fact. I longed to have her share my den, which seemed a more secure retreat than her own, but I had brought so much trouble on my grandmother that it seemed wrong to ask her to incur greater risks. My restlessness increased. I had lived too long in bodily pain and anguish of spirit. Always I was in dread that by some accident or some contrivance slavery would succeed in snatching my children from me. This thought drove me nearly frantic, and I determined to steer for the North Star at all hazards. At this crisis, Providence opened an unexpected way for me to escape. My friend Peter came one evening and asked to speak with me. "Your day has come, Linda," said he. "I have found a chance for you to go to the Free States. You have a fortnight to decide." The news seemed too good to be true, but Peter explained his arrangements and told me all that was necessary was for me to say I would go. I was going to answer him with a joyful yes when the thought of Benny came to my mind. I told him the temptation was exceedingly strong, but I was terribly afraid of Dr. Flynn's alleged power over my child, and that I could not go and leave him behind. Peter remonstrated earnestly. He said such a good chance might never occur again, that Benny was free and could be sent to me, and that for the sake of my children's welfare I ought not to hesitate a moment. I told him I would consult with Uncle Philip. My uncle rejoiced in the plan, and bade me go by all means. He promised, if his life was spared, that he would either bring or send my son to me as soon as I reached a place of safety. I resolved to go, but thought nothing had better be said to my grandmother till very near the time of departure. But my uncle thought she would feel it more keenly if I left here so suddenly. "I will reason with her," said he, "and convince her how necessary it is, not only for your sake, but for hers also. You cannot be blind to the fact that she is sinking under her burdens." I was not blind to it. I knew that my concealment was an ever-present source of anxiety, and that the older she grew, the more nervously fearful she was of discovery. My uncle talked with her, and finally succeeded in persuading her that it was absolutely necessary for me to seize the chance so unexpectedly offered. The anticipation of being a free woman proved almost too much for my weak frame. The excitement stimulated me, and at the same time bewildered me. I made busy preparations for my journey, and for my son to follow me. I resolved to have an interview with him before I went, that I might give him cautions and advice, and tell him how anxiously I should be waiting for him at the North. Grandmother stole up to me as often as possible to whisper words of counsel. She insisted upon writing to Dr. Flint as soon as I arrived in the Free States, and asking him to sell me to her. She said she would sacrifice her house and all she had in the world for the sake of having me safe with my children in any part of the world. If she could only live to know that, she could die in peace. I promised the dear old faithful friend that I would write to her as soon as I arrived, and put the letter in a safe way to reach her. But in my own mind I resolved that not another cent of her hard earnings should be spent to pay rapacious slaveholders for what they called their property. And even if I had not been unwilling to buy what I had already a right to possess, common humanity would have prevented me from accepting the generous offer, at the expense of turning my aged relative out of house and home, when she was trembling on the brink of the grave. I was to escape in a vessel, but I forbear to mention any further particulars. I was in readiness, but the vessel was unexpectedly detained several days. Meantime, news came to town of a most horrible murder committed on a fugitive slave named James. Charity, the mother of this unfortunate young man, had been an old acquaintance of ours. I have told the shocking particulars of his death in my description of some of the neighboring slaveholders. My grandmother, always nervously sensitive about runaways, was terribly frightened. She felt sure that a similar fate awaited me if I did not desist from my enterprise. She sobbed and groaned and entreated me not to go. Her excessive fear was somewhat contagious, and my heart was not proof against her extreme agony. I was grievously disappointed, but I promised to relinquish my project. When my friend Peter was apprised of this, he was both disappointed and vexed. He said that, judging from our past experience, it would be a long time before I had another such chance to throw away. I told him it need not be thrown away, that I had a friend concealed nearby who would be glad enough to take the place that had been provided for me. I told him about poor Fanny, and the kind-hearted noble fellow, who never turned his back upon anybody in distress, white or black, expressed his readiness to help her. Aggie was much surprised when she found that we knew her secret. She was rejoiced to hear of such a chance for Fanny, and arrangements were made for her to go on board the vessel the next night. They both supposed that I had long been at the North, therefore my name was not mentioned in the transaction. Fanny was carried on board at the appointed time, and stowed away in a very small cabin. This accommodation had been purchased at a price that would pay for a voyage to England. But when one proposes to go to fine old England, they stop to calculate whether they can afford the cost of the pleasure. While in making a bargain to escape from slavery, the trembling victim is ready to say, "Take all I have, only don't betray me." The next morning I peeped through my loophole, and saw that it was dark and cloudy. At night I received news that the wind was ahead, and the vessel had not sailed. I was exceedingly anxious about Fanny, and Peter, too, who was running a tremendous risk at my instigation. Next day the wind and weather remained the same. Poor Fanny had been half dead with fright when they carried her on board, and I could readily imagine how she must be suffering now. Grandmother came often to my den to say how thankful she was that I did not go. On the third morning she rapped for me to come down to the storeroom. The poor old sufferer was breaking down under her weight of trouble. She was easily flurried now. I found her in a nervous, excited state, but I was not aware that she had forgotten to lock the door behind her as usual. She was exceedingly worried about the detention of the vessel. She was afraid all would be discovered, and then Fanny and Peter and I would all be tortured to death, and Philip would be utterly ruined, and her house would be torn down. Poor Peter! If he should die such a horrible death as the poor slave James had lately done, and all for his kindness in trying to help me, how dreadful it would be for us all! Alas, the thought was familiar to me, and had sent many a sharp pang through my heart. I tried to suppress my own anxiety and speak soothingly to her. She brought in some allusion to Aunt Nancy, the dear daughter she had recently buried, and then she lost all control of herself. As she stood there, trembling and sobbing, a voice from the piazza called out, "Whar is you, Aunt Marthy?" Grandmother was startled, and in her agitation opened the door without thinking of me. In stepped Jenny, the mischievous housemaid who had tried to enter my room when I was concealed in the house of my white benefactress. "I's been huntin' everywhere for you, Aunt Marthy," said she. "My missus wants you to send her some crackers." I had slunk down behind a barrel which entirely screened me, but I imagined that Jenny was looking directly at the spot, and my heart beat violently. My grandmother immediately thought what she had done and went out quickly with Jenny to count the crackers, locking the door after her. She returned to me in a few minutes, the perfect picture of despair. "Poor child," she exclaimed, "my carelessness has ruined you. The boat ain't gone yet. Get ready immediately and go with Fanny. I ain't got another word to say against it now, for there's no telling what may happen this day." Uncle Philip was sent for, and he agreed with his mother in thinking that Jenny would inform Dr. Flint in less than 24 hours. He advised me getting on board the boat, if possible. If not, I had better keep very still in my den, where they cannot find me without tearing the house down. He said it would not do for him to move in the matter, because suspicion would be immediately excited, but he promised to communicate with Peter. I felt reluctant to apply to him again, having implicated him too much already, but there seemed to be no alternative. Vexed as Peter had been by my indecision, he was true to his generous nature, and said at once that he would do his best to help me, trusting I should show myself a stronger woman this time. He immediately proceeded to the wharf and found that the wind had shifted, and the vessel was slowly beating downstream. On some pretext of urgent necessity, he offered two boatmen $1 apiece to catch up with her. He was of lighter complexion than the boatman he hired, and when the captain saw them coming so rapidly, he thought officers were pursuing his vessel in search of the runaway slave he had on board. They hoisted sails, but the boat gained upon them, and the indefatigable Peter sprang on board. The captain at once recognized him. Peter asked him to go below to speak about a bad bill he had given him. When he told his errand, the captain replied, "Why, the woman's here already, and I've put her where you or the devil would have a tough job to find her." "But it is another woman I want to bring," said Peter. "She is in great distress, too, and you shall be paid anything within reason if you'll stop and take her." "What's her name?" inquired the captain. "Linda," he replied. "That's the name of the woman already here," rejoined the captain. "By George, I believe you mean to betray me." "Oh," exclaimed Peter, "God knows I wouldn't harm a hair of your head. I'm too grateful to you. But there really is another woman in great danger. Do have the humanity to stop and take her." After a while they came to an understanding. Fanny, not dreaming I was anywhere about in that region, had assumed my name, though she called herself Johnson. "Linda is a common name," said Peter, "and the woman I want to bring is Linda Brent." The captain agreed to wait at a certain place till evening, being handsomely paid for his detention. Of course the day was an anxious one for us all. But we concluded that if Jenny had seen me, she would be too wise to let her mistress know of it, and that she probably would not get a chance to see Dr. Flint's family till evening, for I knew very well what were the rules in that household. I afterwards believed that she did not see me, for nothing ever came of it, and she was one of those base characters that would have jumped to betray a suffering fellow being for the sake of 30 pieces of silver. I made all my arrangements to go on board as soon as it was dusk. The intervening time I resolved to spend with my son. I had not spoken to him for 7 years, though I had been under the same roof, and seen him every day when I was well enough to sit at the loophole. I did not dare to venture beyond the storeroom, so they brought him there, and locked us up together, in a place concealed from the piazza door. It was an agitating interview for both of us. After we had talked and wept together for a little while, he said, "Mother, I'm glad you're going away. I wish I could go with you. I knew you was here, and I've been so afraid they would come and catch you." I was greatly surprised, and asked him how he had found it out. He replied, "I was standing under the eaves one day before Ellen went away, and I heard somebody cough up over the woodshed. I don't know what made me think it was you, but I did think so. I missed Ellen the night before she went away, and Grandmother brought her back into the room in the night, and I thought maybe she'd been to see you before she went, for I heard Grandmother whisper to her, 'Now go to sleep, and remember never to tell.' I asked him if he ever mentioned his suspicions to his sister. He said he never did, but after he heard the cough, if he saw her playing with other children on that side of the house, he always tried to coax her round to the other side, for fear that they would hear me cough too. He said he had kept a close lookout for Dr. Flint, and if he saw him speak to a constable or a patrol, he always told Grandmother. I now recollected that I had seen him manifest uneasiness when people were on that side of the house, and I had at the time been puzzled to conjecture a motive for his actions. Such prudence may seem extraordinary in a boy of 12 years, but slaves, being surrounded by mysteries, deceptions, and dangers, early learn to be suspicious and watchful, and prematurely cautious and cunning. He had never asked a question of Grandmother, or Uncle Philip, and I had often heard him chime in with other children when they spoke of my being at the North. I told him I was now really going to the Free States, and if he was a good, honest boy and a loving child to his dear old grandmother, the Lord would bless him and bring him to me, and we and Ellen would live together. He began to tell me that Grandmother had not eaten anything all day. While he was speaking, the door was unlocked, and she came in with a small bag of money which she wanted me to take. I begged her to keep a part of it at least to pay for Benny's being sent to the North, but she insisted, while her tears were falling fast, that I should take the whole. "You may be sick among strangers," she said, "and they would send you to the poorhouse to die." Ah, that good grandmother! For the last time I went up to my nook. Its desolate appearance no longer chilled me, for the light of hope had risen in my soul. Yet even with the blessed prospect of freedom before me, I felt very sad at leaving forever that old homestead where I had been sheltered so long by the dear old grandmother, where I had dreamed my first young dream of love, and where after that had faded away, my children came to twine themselves so closely round my desolate heart. As the hour approached for me to leave, I again descended to the storeroom. My grandmother and Benny were there. She took me by the hand and said, "Linda, let us pray." We knelt down together, with my child pressed to my heart, and my other arm round the faithful, loving old friend I was about to leave forever. On no other occasion has it ever been my lot to listen to so fervent a supplication for mercy and protection. It thrilled through my heart, and inspired me with trust in God. Peter was waiting for me in the street. I was soon by his side, faint in body, but strong of purpose. I did not look back upon the old place, though I felt that I should never see it again. Chapter 30. Northward Bound. I never could tell how we reached the wharf. My brain was all of a whirl, and my limbs tottered under me. At an appointed place we met my Uncle Philip, who had started before us on a different route, that he might reach the wharf first and give us timely warning if there was any danger. A rowboat was in readiness. As I was about to step in, I felt something pull me gently, and turning round, I saw Benny, looking pale and anxious. He whispered in my ear, "I've been peeping into the doctor's window, and he's at home. Goodbye, Mother. Don't cry. I'll come." He hastened away. I clasped the hand of my good uncle, to whom I owed so much, and of Peter, the brave, generous friend who had volunteered to run such terrible risks to secure my safety. To this day I remember how his bright face beamed with joy when he told me he had discovered a safe method for me to escape. Yet that intelligent, enterprising, noble-hearted man was a chattel, liable by the laws of a country that calls itself civilized, to be sold with horses and pigs. We parted in silence. Our hearts were all too full for words. Swiftly the boat glided over the water. After a while one of the sailors said, "Don't be downhearted, madam. We'll take you safely to your husband, and—" I could not imagine what he meant, but I had presence of mind to think that it probably referred to something the captain had told him, so I thanked him, and said I hoped we should have pleasant weather. When I entered the vessel, the captain came forward to meet me. He was an elderly man with a pleasant countenance. He showed me to a little box of a cabin, where sat my friend Fanny. She started as if she had seen a spectre. She gazed on me in utter astonishment and exclaimed, "Linda, can this be you, or is it your ghost?" When we were locked in each other's arms, my overwrought feelings could no longer be restrained. My sobs reached the ears of the captain, who came and very kindly reminded us that for his safety as well as our own it would be prudent for us not to attract any attention. He said that when there was a sail in sight he wished us to keep below, but at other times he had no objection to our being on deck. He assured us that he would keep a good lookout, and if we acted prudently he thought we should be in no danger. He had represented us as women going to meet our husbands in— We thanked him and promised to observe carefully all the directions he gave us. Fanny and I now talked by ourselves, low and quietly, in our little cabin. She told me of the suffering she had gone through in making her escape, and of her terrors while she was concealed in her mother's house. Above all, she dwelt on the agony of separation from all her children on that dreadful auction day. She could scarcely credit me when I told her of the place where I had passed nearly 7 years. "We have the same sorrows," said I. "No," replied she, "you are going to see your children soon, and there is no hope that I shall ever even hear from mine." The vessel was soon under way, but we made slow progress. The wind was against us. I should not have cared for this if we had been out of sight of the town, but until there were miles of water between us and our enemies, we were filled with constant apprehensions that the constables would come on board. Neither could I feel quite at ease with the captain and his men. I was an entire stranger to that class of people, and I had heard that sailors were rough and sometimes cruel. We were so completely in their power that if they were bad men, our situation would be dreadful. Now that the captain was paid for our passage, might he not be tempted to make more money by giving us up to those who claimed us as property? I was naturally of a confiding disposition, but slavery had made me suspicious of everybody. Fanny did not share my distrust of the captain or his men. She said she was afraid at first, but she had been on board 3 days while the vessel lay in the dock, and nobody had betrayed her, or treated her otherwise than kindly. The captain soon came to advise us to go on deck for fresh air. His friendly and respectful manner, combined with Fanny's testimony, reassured me, and we went with him. He placed us in a comfortable seat and occasionally entered into conversation. He told us he was a Southerner by birth and had spent the greater part of his life in the slave states, and that he had recently lost a brother who traded in slaves. "But," said he, "it is a pitiable and degrading business, and I always felt ashamed to acknowledge my brother in connection with it." As we passed Snaky Swamp, he pointed to it and said, "There is a slave territory that defies all the laws." I thought of the terrible days I had spent there, and though it was not called Dismal Swamp, it made me feel very dismal as I looked at it. I shall never forget that night. The balmy air of spring was so refreshing, and how shall I describe my sensations when we were fairly sailing on Chesapeake Bay? Oh, the beautiful sunshine, the exhilarating breeze, and I could enjoy them without fear or restraint. I had never realized what grand things air and sunlight are till I had been deprived of them. 10 days after we left land, we were approaching Philadelphia. The captain said we should arrive there in the night, but he thought we had better wait till morning and go on shore in broad daylight as the best way to avoid suspicion. I replied, "You know best, but will you stay on board and protect us?" He saw that I was suspicious, and he said he was sorry, now that he had brought us to the end of our voyage, to find I had so little confidence in him. Ah, if he had ever been a slave, he would have known how difficult it was to trust a white man. He assured us that we might sleep through the night without fear, that he would take care we were not left unprotected. Be it said to the honor of this captain, Southerner as he was, that if Fanny and I had been white ladies, and our passage lawfully engaged, he could not have treated us more respectfully. My intelligent friend Peter had rightly estimated the character of the man to whose honor he had entrusted us. The next morning I was on deck as soon as the day dawned. I called Fanny to see the sunrise, for the first time in our lives, on free soil, for such I then believed it to be. We watched the reddening sky and saw the great orb come up slowly out of the water, as it seemed. Soon the waves began to sparkle, and everything caught the beautiful glow. Before us lay the city of strangers. We looked at each other, and the eyes of both were moistened with tears. We had escaped from slavery, and we supposed ourselves to be safe from the hunters. But we were alone in the world, and we had left dear ties behind us, ties cruelly sundered by the demon slavery. End of chapter 30.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap up the second audio segment. I was looking at the inflation calculator. I think this happened with 12 Years a Slave, perhaps, or one of the books that we read from an earlier time period. But they said, Harriet Jacobs, Fanny, that they paid $100 for, I guess you didn't hear the audio, but note number one for the chapter that we just read. It reads, I'll read you the footnote. talking about the money that they paid for the passage. So footnote number one for Northward Bound. The FARE fare from Edmonton to Philadelphia would have been about $100, plus whatever the captain would have charged for taking on Negroes, they said fugitives. And they gave the source. So I went to an inflation calculator to see what is $100 in 1840, what is that in 2019 money? And so the conversion, that would be a little less than $3,000, right at, I mean, you know, a piece of cornbread short of $3,000 is what we'd be talking about. So, I mean, that is a substantial amount. And it was, that was just the base, and then whatever we're going to add. So the standard fee is 100, and then you're a fugitive negress. So, I mean, oh, wow, that could be triple, who knows, a substantial amount of money that we're talking to even pull this off. Again, going back to what Edward Baptist said, most runaways were not successful. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate.
Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, thoughts to share, again, if anybody had an opportunity to read the report that Dr. Kevorkian submitted on Harriet Jacobs, if you had any thoughts, that would be grand. It does have some interesting information, just pointing out different areas in the book that deserve extra thought, especially critical thought, given that a white person edited the text. Mr. Demery Four, I'll look for other hands as we proceed, if folks have commentary.
Yes. I haven't had a chance to check that report out, but I think I will as soon as the broadcast is over. But when you started to talk about how difficult it was for a runaway and how much it costs, you know, it dawned on me that this is like a pattern, you know, where whites create the situation and charge you to get out of it. And it's going on even today with, they call them coyotes now, and they bring the human traffic for, you know, Mexicans who are paid to come here. And a coyote takes all that money. He may get them, you know, across the border and even to a city, but then turn them over to the authorities, and all their money is gone down the drain, and some of them talk like they've done that 2-3 times. So that same pattern, you know, of just, you know, creating misery and then compounding. And then what about, they mentioned Jenny. She was the handmaiden, I guess the slave girl, inside her attic, you know, that lived in the house. And now she talked about her. She may have seen her, and that she was a base human being that would have sold a person 30 bits of silver. You know, it seems like it's more venom, you know, shot towards people of color or the enslaved people than the white people who's created this whole inhumane situation. And it's just probably going to get bad to worse, because now she's on the run. And I will say that it looks like she's getting smart, because she's getting cautious and being suspicious. And that's the beginning of knowledge when you're dealing with a system like we are, a system of white supremacy. I mute my line, yes.
Suspicion. Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Yeah, the report is fascinating. I'm going to try and see if I can get my hands on a couple of the different articles he suggested or referenced. Let's see. The section on, and I'll even pause here because the report, again, it's titled Harriet Jacobs' Autobiography and the Voice of Lydia Maria Child, Suspected Race Soldier, by Albert Tricomi. That's it. He talks about how Miss Child, like her passion was about patriarchy and women doing their duty and taking care of the home. Like these were some of the things that were she was passionate about. And in my view, that's what's reflected in the text. That's where the focus ends up being. That's what he talks about in this article, where it's focused on how slavery corrupts white families. It corrupts white women. You've got the white male enslavers. They're running out and raping the female slaves, that this corrupts them. And then it breaks up all the Negro families. The children are being ripped away from the parents, and the parents can't even be parents. They're doing this and being slaves, and the children are being chewed up by dogs and sold off, and they're being raped and all of that. That's where the focus seems to be on how this institution corrupts femininity, corrupts masculinity, corrupts the family in general. Not, hey, white people, get it together. White people in the North, especially, because that's the audience, white women. That's what, the part I read before. Get it together. We need to end slavery right now. Not, oh, man, isn't this so sad? Look how it just corrupts everybody. This is terrible. Like, no. I think that's really important. And a lot of that came through in the second audio segment that we just read. We started with Aunt Nancy. So we have the funeral of this black female, and you, all of that just kind of comes through there, and like, oh, this is terrible. It's corrupted the white woman. And she's here, Mrs. Flint. And she's just got this Negro sleeping at her feet for her entire life. And one thing that I did before I get back to that, one thing that did stand out to me hugely in this section where they're talking about all the children that Aunt Nancy lost as a result of being abused and terrorized. Prenatal yoga instructor, that is long running in terms of black females and the trauma around giving birth and just having no regard for black motherhood. We don't care if you're pregnant. You're a Negro. That means you can be beaten, whipped, chained. They talked about that, how they devised special torture techniques for pregnant Negroes, because we don't want to lose the baby. That's, you know, we could sell the Negro after he's born, but we're still going to beat you. Don't think, you know, we care about you just because, you know, you're 7 months, 8 months, you know, who cares? That's slagging an animal. You see that same sort of disregard talked about with Aunt Nancy in the text here. Let's see, where in this chapter, and that's the feeling that I got here, like, oh man, now she's died, poor Nancy. And she's been there the whole time, just sleeping at this Mrs. Phillips' feet to make sure that she's taken care of and taking care of her children and neglecting her own children. Heard that so many times. It says Mrs. Flint graciously complied with her wish, though she said it was painful for her to have. Oh, this is, make sure I get the whole context. It had never occurred to Mrs. Flint that slaves could have any feelings. When my grandmother was consulted, she had once said she wanted Nancy to lie with all the rest of her family and where her own old body would be buried. Mrs. Flint graciously complied with her wish, though she said it was painful to have Nancy buried away from her, her in italics. She might have added with touching pathos, I was so long used to sleeping with her lying near me on the entry floor. I thought this was important. The delectable Negro, again, necrophilia, the consumption, often sexual, of black bodies, even sounding like, man, it would have been great to have that Negro's corpse up here I could nuzzle up to at night and use as a, you know, doorstep or foot warmer or anything. We talked about that before, medical apartheid. The abuse continued even after death. You don't get out of it. The abuse continues. We might go dig you up and, you know, do God knows what with your remains. But it reminded me of that. And then the same thing that I said before, like this kind of showing like, oh, man, Mrs. Flint's a victim too, how she's been corrupted. This is, you know, terrible what this has done to her. Her moral compass is off. I felt like that's the way that this kind of reads, not this is white pathology at its finest and an indictment of white women. Can't have a system of racism, white supremacy without the white woman. I don't, that's not the way. I feel like you'd already have to have that understanding to be picking that out as we go. Let's see. Preparations for escape. She says, I promised the dear old faithful friend that I would write to her as soon as I arrived and put the letter in a safe way to reach her. But in my own mind, I resolved that not another cent of her hard earnings should be spent to pay rapacious slaveholders for what they called their property. Again, I said that's, you know, seems to be throughout the text, the notion of black people paying white people for quote unquote freedom that they never get. You just pay and pay. And but Mr. Dimrefore said that you just pay and pay and pay and pay. That's what they do with workplace racism. You just pay and pay and pay and pay, and the problem never gets solved. Let's see. The same thing that I said now, I think it was the very first week. We've only been reading this book 4 weeks, and it looks like we could be done next week. The very first week that we read this book, I said that the word kind is in this book, and not as in type or brand, but kind as in nice, courteous, pleasant. That word is in this book dozens of times, generally referring to a white person and how kind they are, often not just a white person, but a white slave master. The passage, this is from chapter 30, and she's talking about these whites who are on the slave ship, or that were not slave ship, sorry, the ship where they're going to Philadelphia to get to free, not slave ship, we hope, where they've paid in today's money about $3,000. Well, actually, the base price is $3,000. So who knows? That could be $10,000, $7,000 to see if they can get a boat ride up to Philadelphia. She writes, be it said to the honor of this captain, Southerner as he was, that if Fanny and I had been white ladies and our passage lawfully engaged, he could not have treated us more respectfully. My intelligent friend Peter had rightly estimated the character of the man to whose honor he had entrusted us. This sounds like another one. Now, again, if this is not the norm, this is what I said, I think the very first week that we started reading this book, and I was like, wow, something about this just seems like the fingerprints of racists. This is atypical in a system of racism, white supremacy, 1861 when this book was published, or 2019. This is atypical in a system of white supremacy. We can't consistently every other page keep coming back to kindly, honorable white women and white men. That, I mean, it just can't be that, oh yeah, we did have gruesome old Dr. Flint, gruesome old Mrs. Flint, had niggers out stepping on in front of her door, but then we got the kindly shipmaster and kind, I mean, it just comes up way too much. That's, you know, another one where I'd say, yeah, that sounds like white influence, racist influence to me. And how would you even know to make this sort of comparison? I mean, have you traveled that much? How do you know how a lawfully engaged white traveler is treated so that you compare that to how you were treated on the ship? I'm certain that they would not have been expected to pay anything above what the FARE of the ticket was supposed to be, not an additional nigger tax. That would just be one guess. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound, star 61 if you have thoughts, questions, check in. With any of the folks, if you have thought something that stood out during the text, any thoughts about the influence of the wife, anything sounded a little strange, odd, thinking about a little bit more, knowing that a white woman had a heavy hand in, at minimum, the arrangement of the book and what's here and what's not here, knowing that there was at least a chapter on John Brown that was supposed to be the climax of the text that was dumped. And, you know, who knows what else could have been. I have my suspicions, as I've been trying to point out as we proceed. But again, we could be wrapping this text up next week. It's not very long, thankfully. But for other folks, if you have a thought, question you would like to share, go ahead, next few minutes or so. If folks do not have any thoughts, what have you, we can wrap up early. Again, we're almost done with the text. I didn't know it was this short. We'll be done before we even get to Virginia for the Cal's 10-year anniversary yoga retreat. I will take this moment. Reading is more important than watching television. Lots of things to prepare for the Cal's yoga retreat. Lots of things to prepare. I was trying to get ready for today's broadcast. Had extra reading because I was trying to read the report Dr. Kevorkian mailed to me, which I was glad I was able to make time to do that as well. It snowed this week in Seattle. It never snows here. They're saying that it may snow 20 inches in Seattle. Not sure if I've even seen that much snow here ever. All of that aside, I stopped by the local library, one of 20 in the greater Seattle area. So I stopped by the library. It's Negro History Month. They have a big display in the front of the library for Negro History Month with all of these books by Negro authors. Speaking of which, they don't have incidents in the life, although I wouldn't have been surprised if it had been there. So I'm kind of in a hurry. I'm not really looking for anything to pick up. I have things to do. But I glance and I see, you know, book, boom, 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 some of the texts that they have up. Of course, they have the New American Classic. That's at the very top of the shelf, the display, The Hate U Give, Angie Thomas. That's, you know, the best of the best, I reckon. But they have a list of other texts, Black Girl Magic and a few others. I forget the name. And I stop and I say, wow, all of the authors appear to be Black females, except for one. And so I stop again. Again, I'm kind of in a hurry. I don't, you know, really have time, but it's just like, did I look at this correctly? Are there no Black males? Did they put up a display for Black History Month and every author is a Black female except for one? So I go to the desk, which is en route to the whole reason that I came to the library. I'm just doing this in passing. And I say, you have a Black History display up and there's one Black male author. That just seems very disproportionate. Do Black males not write books? We couldn't find any other Black males that have written a book to place up. And she said, well, oh, the person who put the display up, she's available. You can talk to her. She's a staff member. I can go get her. And I said, oh, okay. So I'm waiting around. I'm dual tasking. She comes out and I say, yeah, if you did the display, it's extremely disproportionate. There's no Black male representation at all, hardly. I think I saw one book, and there certainly are Black males who have written text. You know, I think it's important that you would include both. I don't have a problem with Black female authors, but we can't include any Black male authors. And she said, oh, well, we have other books in the library. And I said, I'm sure you do, but if this is the display and this is the first thing that you see when you walk into the library, it should be representative, yes. And she said, oh, yeah, that's a good point. We can switch the books around. I said, well, I would appreciate it if you do switch the books around and include more Black males. In fact, there was just a report where Black children, especially young Black boys, where it's difficult for them to find books written by Black male authors. It's very important that people see that Black males do, in fact, write books and read a book occasionally. So yes, I think it does need to be changed immediately. And she said, thank you for bringing that to our attention. We will go ahead and make that change. So I will report back and let you know if they do. I assisted in the change. I immediately went and removed The Hate U Give. I thought about throwing it in the trash, but I just put it in the reshelf bin. I'm hoping that they will place it back on the shelf and not at the top of the Negro History Month display, but that did happen. Reading is more important than watching television. Case of Black male privilege at the Seattle Public Library. Anyway, back to this text and the hidden hand of the white woman. If other folks have any thoughts they want to make sure they get in, you have about 2 minutes or so, if we don't have any other thoughts or questions on this week's section of the text. We will call that a broadcast. Again, I can only say I did not know about this white woman's influence on the text in all of the years that I've heard about this text, reverenced generally for it, and people saying this is great. Generally, this will be the type of text that I'm accustomed to seeing on displays for Black History Month. I really didn't hear people saying, oh, yeah, great text, or what informative text you can learn, whatever you can learn from it, but a white woman did do the editing for this book, and that's something that should be kept in mind as we read. Where do we think her influence pops up at? How does that influence how we critically analyze this text? Talking about, you know, reading comprehension, as they say, and critical reading skills. That's important anytime you're reading a text and knowing, well, how have racists possibly manipulated this information that I'm getting? Because unfortunately, that is frequently going to be the case as long as we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. Something that I hope has come across in the book, again, because we've had to talk about this so many times in book clubs where there are black books ostensibly written by black authors, but asterisk, white helper. And that happens a lot of times directly, indirectly, if it's an editor, or sometimes they're just, you know, co-writing the text, as was the case here. Anywho, everybody satisfied? Anything else folks need to get out, or everyone good for this segment? Assume.
Yes, sir.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery. For if I'm able to get my hands on the other report that Dr. Kevorkian talked about, I think he mentioned at least three. There was one in particular that I want to make sure that I'm able to check on. If I'm able to get it, I'll share that as well. And we will be wrapping up next week, and I believe the 10-year anniversary yoga retreat will be 2 weeks from today. So we might have a day off in between, or a week off in between, before we switch to the next book. But we should be done next week. I might be incorrect about that. I looked really hard today to see if I was looking at the audio correctly, but we might be done next Thursday. Incidents in life. Quick. Quick and easy. We will be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. The Cows Yoga Retreat has even got contributions or caused commentary related to workplace racism. Non-white people, well, I can't say unfortunately, the retreat is scheduled for 2 weekdays. It's starting late in the day on Thursday, so ostensibly you know, would not necessarily have to miss work on Thursday, depending on how far you have to travel. But Friday, definitely, because it's all day Friday. So if you're going to be there, people are having to take Friday off. And folks have talked about how whites have made that interesting, them getting a day off for the retreat. But that'll be tomorrow, Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here Saturday as well. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. I think we should be here Sunday. Brian Grogan, white male, Virginia resident, did research on them closing the schools in Virginia. This is in the 1960s. They closed the schools in Prince Edward County, Virginia, for 5 years because they didn't want Negroes in school with white children. And he, there's a book written about this. We've talked about this repeatedly through the 10 years of the Cows. We've had many white authors come on and talk about their works and what have you. He came on the program back in 2012. He's looking to do a documentary film about this period in Virginia state history. So all of this happens in Virginia over the past week with the governor, Governor Northam, Coon Man Northam, coming out with the yearbook photo in blackface, and then the attorney general coming out and saying that he dressed up in blackface as Curtis Blow. And then I forgot the latest person, another white person who is in pretty high ranking state official coming out and saying the same thing, that he edited the yearbook or something. And it's a whole bunch of blackface photos in that, too. So all of these high-ranking Virginia officials, most of them have been Democrats, one Republican. I thought it would be grand to have Mr. Grogan back on to kind of put all of this in context of Virginia state history and the system of racism, white supremacy. But he should be here. Always enjoy talking to white folks. So white man, he should be here on Sunday. And yeah, so we should be here tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday, next 3 days, context of white supremacy. And I guess I'll add weather permitting, because they seem pretty serious about the weather out here being treacherous. They're calling for snow tomorrow, and they said it could be 20 inches of snow in Seattle beginning middle of next week. I don't know if that'll happen or not. Again, I'm not sure I've ever seen that much snow in Seattle, maybe one time that I can recall where we had that type of blizzard weather. But I mean, that is an extraordinary rarity in these here parts. So if things get wacky, I will try to update. Hopefully, you know, won't get that bad, or at minimum, maybe it snows and we're still broadcasting. So I can just say that, yes, we are having all kinds of problems with whiteness in an entirely different way and still going about the business of ending white supremacy racism. We'll keep you posted. Much obliged for the folks who listened. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Racists for centuries. Racists for centuries have terrorized and taken advantage of a lot of black non-white people worldwide who were not thinking correctly because we were under the influence, generally, of toxins they provide. I think Dr. Welsing and many others would encourage us, let's keep our brain computers protected, working optimally so that we can solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with slave catchers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm a up. Victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.